Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars, Before the Storm, Book One of the Black Fleet Crisis by Michael P. Cuby McDowell.
Months after the Battle of Endor, Gian Parrott, commander of the Imperial garrison at the Empire's orbiting repair yard at Nazoth, codenamed Flak 15, received a command from his superiors.
You are ordered to evacuate the planetary garrison to the last man, using any and all ships that are spaceworthy. Destroy the repair yard before withdrawing from the system.
There were 9 ships in the yard. Only one, the Intimidator, was ready for space. But there was more than enough room aboard it for the garrison, and more than enough firepower to destroy the yard and the hulls within. Parrott transferred his command to the bridge of the Intimidator within an hour of receiving his orders. 9 of every 10 workers on Black 15 were Yavetha. Nils Farr, master of the Yavethan underground, knew Parrott was trying to prepare for the departure without alerting the Yavetha. He knew all that Parrott knew, and much more. Nothing of importance happened without his hearing of it, and he had taken the information he collected and woven it into an elegant scheme. Now he gave orders of his own. Notify all teams that an Imperial evacuation has been ordered. Execute the primary plan without delay. It is our day for retribution. Our blood is in those vessels, and they will be ours. Nils Farr and the first commando team entered the bridge of the Intimidator with weapons drawn, knowing exactly which stations would be occupied. He shouted no warnings, demanded no surrender. He simply walked briskly across the deck toward the executive officer, raised his blaster, and burned the man's face away. The rest of the team fanned out behind him, each to his own assigned target. 6 of the bridge crew were struck down in the first seconds. The others, including Commander Parrott, quickly ended up on the floor, hands bound behind them.
Signal from the governor's shuttle, called out a Yavetha commando. The transports are leaving the surface.
Like a cluster of insects returning to the hive, the Imperial fleet rose up from Nazoth toward the great dagger-shaped star destroyer. More than 20,000 citizens of the Empire were on board the transports, obeying orders to dock in the Intimidator for escape.
Activate all auto-targeting batteries, said Nils Farr. You're all cowards, Commander Parrott called out to the invaders. He had always despised the skeletal Yavethan. There's no honor in killing the defenseless.
Fire, said Nils Farr.
The deck plate barely vibrated as the gun batteries erupted and the approaching transports disappeared in balls of fire and fragments. Nils Farr crossed the bridge to where Parrott lay on the decking. A sharp, curving dew claw emerged from the swelling at his wrist. You are vermin. And he slashed the claw across the Imperial captain's throat. 12 years later. In the pristine silence of space, the 5th battle group of the New Republic Defense Fleet blossomed over the planet Vesemir like a beautiful, deadly flower. The formation of capital ships sprang into view with startling suddenness, trailing fire-white wings and bristling with weapons. Angular star destroyers guarded flat-hulled fleet carriers, while the assault cruisers, their mirror finishes gleaming, took the point. A halo of smaller ships appeared at the same time. The fighters among them quickly deployed in a spherical defensive screen. As the star destroyers firmed up their formation, their flight decks quickly spawned scores of additional fighters. The carriers and cruisers began to disgorge the bombers, transports, and gunboats they had ferried to the battle. Before long, more than 200 warships were bearing down on Vesemir and its twin moons. At the center of the formation of great vessels was the flagship of the 5th battle group, the fleet carrier Intrepid.
She was so new from the yards at Hakasi that her corridor still reeked of sealing compound and cleaning solvent. On Intrepid's bridge, a tall Dornian, in a general's uniform, paced along an arc of command stations equipped with large monitors. His eye folds were swollen, and his leathery face was flushed purple by concern. "Penetration phase complete," sang out a lieutenant at one of the consoles. "Deployment complete. Assault leader is approaching wave off failsafe and requests final authorization." General Abbott responded in a strong, confident voice.
"Failsafe authorization is go. Combat rules are green."
Almost at once, a trio of assault cruisers and their complement of K-wing bombers broke away and surged ahead of the primary formation. Their course would take them looping under the planet's south pole en route to the primary space fighter base and planetary defense batteries located on the Alpha Moon. Pairs of speedy A-wing fighters flashed out of formation and fanned out to intercept and destroy the planet's lightly armed sensor and communication satellites. The A-wings fired the first shots of the assault, transforming their targets into sparkling clouds of metal and plasteel. The A-wings also drew the first opposing fire. Several ion cannon batteries on the surface opened up in a vain attempt to protect their high-orbiting eyes. Moments after the ground batteries revealed their location, gunners on the League Republic assault cruisers had them targeted. On the far side of Vesemir, the cruiser detachment approached the Alpha Moon on a high-speed collision course. As drone fighters appeared from concealed launch chutes on the surface, the big ships fanned out three abreast and began releasing clusters of penetration bombs. The concussion shattered reinforced walls like matchsticks and collapsed underground chambers like eggshells. Great plumes of gray dust shot out of the launch chutes, and the ground itself subsided over what had been the planet's main hangar. Standing at a podium and wearing the uniform of the Joint Defense Operations Staff, rather than the Mon Calamari battle dress in which he earned his fame, Admiral Akbar gestured with a flippered hand toward a display screen.
"With the Fifth Fleet firmly in control of local space, it is now relatively safe for the gunships to begin opening a corridor to the surface. Our strategy is to expose well-armored vessels to enemy fire in order to locate and destroy the defensive emplacements in the target sector."
The monitors in the conference hall at the New Republic Defense Forces headquarters on Coruscant showed much the same images as those on Intrepid's bridge, though lagging some seconds behind. The audience included all eight members of the Senate's Council on the Common Defense, half a dozen senior fleet officers, and Princess Leia Organa Solo, President of the Senate and Commander-in-Chief of the New Republic's Defense Forces.
"Admiral Akbar, a question,"
Senator Tolik Yar called out.
"How realistic a test is this for the Fifth Fleet? Is it anything more than a scripted performance?"
"It is as realistic as possible. This is an operational readiness exercise, not a simulation. It is true that the fleet is opposed only by battle drones and computer sims, but I can assure you that the defense team takes pride in constructing a difficult problem for the fleet tacticians."
Senator Sion Marouk rose from his seat and allowed the heavily veined air sacs on his back to fully inflate.
"Admiral Akbar, this has been a most impressive demonstration so far, but on behalf of my colleagues and those we represent, I must wonder why command of the new task force was given to such a newcomer."
"Senator, General Itan Abbott has a long and exemplary record as a fleet commander with the Dornian Navy. Though Dornia was not part of the Rebel Alliance, it has its own heroes in the fight against the Empire. We are fortunate to be able to call on General Abbott's services."
Senator Tig Paramus rose from his seat.
"Admiral Akbar, I have questions concerning the conditions of the test."
Leia immediately perked up. Senator Paramus was the newest member of the Council on the Common Defense, representing the worlds of the 7th Security Zone, including his own, Walala. So far, he had been a quiet member, diligently studying the council records that his new level of clearance opened to him, asking many thoughtful questions and expressing few opinions.
"Proceed," said Admiral Akbar.
"You chose to send the Fifth Fleet against a target that lacks a planetary shield, was that?"
"Senator, It is not possible to assault a planet which enjoys the protection of a planetary shield until that shield has been disabled. We would learn nothing about our new invasive tactics from such an exercise. And there are far more worlds like Besimir than there are worlds with the wealth and technology to sustain a planet-wide shield.
But Senator Paramus was not satisfied.
Exactly who are you preparing to invade? Did you build the Fifth Fleet to protect us against a strategic threat, or to strengthen Coruscant?
Leia moved to the front of the room with a purposeful stride and a swirl of robes. I can only think that if you had been here when the votes were taken, Senator Paramus, you would not ask such questions. You unfairly malign Admiral Akbar's honor. Paramus looked purposefully at Leia.
I do not malign him in the slightest. I'm sure Admiral Akbar is faithful in his duties and loyal to his superiors.
Senator Tolik Yar leapt to his feet.
How dare you! If you do not withdraw your words, I will knock you down myself.
Leia sent a small, tight smile in the direction of her champion, but waved off his assistance. Senator Paramus, the Fifth Fleet was built to protect the New Republic, and for no other reason. We have no territorial aspirations, no hunger for conquest. How could we, with 10 new applications for membership arriving every day? On the honor of the House of Organa, I give my word. The Fifth Fleet will never be used to invade a member world or subdue its legitimate ambitions. Senator Paramus swept his gaze across the room.
What weight shall I give to a vow made on the honor of an extinct family? What I've learned in the months since I took my council oath, what I've heard and seen today, alarms me profoundly. The Fifth Fleet is a weapon of conquest and tyranny, nothing less and nothing more. And once a weapon is forged, it tantalizes and tempts and transfixes until someone finds a reason to use it.
A hot, humid breeze blew across the crown of Temple Atum, the steepest of the ruined temples of the Masasi on Yavin 4. Luke Skywalker turned his face into the wind and looked out over the vibrant jungle that stretched unbroken to the horizon. The enormous orange disk of the gas giant Yavin dominated the sky, hanging just above the edge of the world as its fourth moon turned toward night. This I will miss, Luke thought. Something tickled at the hazy fringe of his awareness. He closed his eyes, reading the currents of the Force as they flowed around and beneath him. There was life everywhere, for the creatures of Yavin 4 had long ago claimed what the Masasi had abandoned. Collapsed stairways limited most vermin to the lower levels, but stone bats had made nests in tiny ventilation shafts all over the temple's face. And Luke shared the area with purple-winged kite hawks, which soared into the sky each evening to search the jungle's upper canopy for prey. There was an unfamiliar presence, too, but not an unexpected one. Streen was coming, as Luke had asked. Concealing himself by exerting no will at all on the currents of the Force, Luke marked his protege's progress. He moved lightly through the rookeries of the temple, sure-footedly through the dark passages. The last 50 meters of the trip to the crown required a dizzying fingertips and toes climb up the steep, crumbling face of Temple Atum. As Stream neared the top, Luke nudged the kite hawks into the air with a thought. They passed over Stream's head like beclawed shadows, crying and beating the air with their wings, but Stream did not startle. Luke opened his eyes as Stream joined him. I'm pleased. You've confirmed me in my choice. Come, sit and face the east with me. Streen complied wordlessly. Streen, I am leaving in the morning. I am no longer needed here. It is time for someone else to take over the academy. I've chosen you. Those words succeeded in startling Streen in a way the kite hawks had failed to.
Leaving? I don't understand.
Luke stood and looked back toward the great temple. Once the Force was to me like a whispered voice on the wind. Obi-Wan taught me to hear it, and Yoda to understand it. and in my turn I taught others to hear and understand. But I have not been hearing that voice well of late. Though my hearing is more acute than ever, there are too many questions, too many demands. Everyone seems to be shouting at me. He turned back to Streen. I can no longer do this work, and the work I have to do cannot be done here. Streen rose to his feet.
Then it is time for you to leave. Past time, I think, now that I understand why you have been pulling away from us. And I will not ask where you are going.
Thank you. Do you accept the burden I have offered you?
Yes.
Streen offered his open hand.
I accept it. I free you in good conscience from your duty.
Later in the small hours of night, a solitary E-wing fighter made an arrow of light across the sky, climbing from the jungle toward the stars. Only one pair of eyes saw it go. Streen. He was seated atop the great temple, meditating.
Goodbye, my teacher. May the Force be with you on your journey.
Raising Jedi children, Han Solo decided, was like raising Raltir tigers. Cute as they were when young, and much as they might love you, they still grew long, deadly claws. After the children had been kidnapped by Hethrir and nearly lost, Han had asked to resign his commission so that he could remain close to home. Admiral Akbar had refused, but he had heard the concern behind Han's request and assigned him instead to serve as liaison for domestic defense. This meant that while Leia took care of the Senate, Han took care of the three children, the twins, Jaina and Jason, and young Anakin. They had established a new family ritual that seemed to please everyone. When Leia came home, they would all climb into the vortex pool in the garden and spend half an hour or more being carried around by its currents. Then, while the children were off with the valet droid dressing for dinner, Han and Leia retreated to their bedroom for what they jokingly called the daily briefing. It was as much a part of the ritual as the pool, a chance for them to swap stories about their day. That evening, Leia threw herself on the bed and hugged a pillow to her chest. What news from the front, General? Han let himself drop into a Kesslerite lounging chair. It quickly softened and conformed to his body shape.
I don't know what to do about Jason. I told him he had to start doing something physical, strengthen his body, or I'd have to assign him a few laps around the inner fence with the sentry droid every day.
What did he say to that?
He said, why do I have to be strong? Someday I'll be able to go anywhere I want, just by thinking about it, like Uncle Luke.
Han shook his head.
I'd be glad to see Luke remind Jason about the physical side of Jedi training. You know, all that stuff he used to bore us with, about the body being the instrument of the mind, not just its vessel.
Leia rolled over and propped herself up on her elbows, her expression suddenly earnest. Han, have you heard anything from Luke? Han frowned while he thought.
Well, not for a long time. Why?
I heard from Tion on Yavin 4 today. Luke's disappeared.
Disappeared?
Gone off somewhere. He turned over the academy to Streen.
He's done that before.
From what Tion said, this time was different. It sounded like he was never coming back.
If he's not going to be at the academy, we could surely use his help here.
As soon as Luke shut down the engines, he could hear the wind howling outside. It rocked the E-wing on its skids and pelted its surface with freezing salt spray, ripped from the waves breaking near the beach. Luke turned to the R7-T1 droid as he unbuckled his harness. Keep the stabilizers on. I'll be back when I've found the hangar. The beach was barely 30 meters wide, squeezed between an angry-looking greenish sea and a high rocky cliff. Just beyond the breakers, sculpted spires of reddish-black rock jutted up from the water. Overhead, a thick gray mat of clouds churned as the wind drove it briskly along. Oblivious to the cold and wind, Luke walked slowly along the rocky beach. He held one hand out in front of him, palm down, sweeping it methodically back and forth through the air, like a blind man feeling his way through an unfamiliar room. He had not gone far when he stopped and looked up at the top of the cliff for a long moment. Then at the spires of rock. Yes. Yes. It is here. He sat down on the sand, cross-legged and straight-backed, and brought his hands together in his lap, fingertip to fingertip. Concentrating on a picture in his mind, Luke dipped his awareness deeply into the flow of the Force. With eyes that looked inward, he found what he was seeking. The sand around him stirred. The rocks shuddered, shifted, and began to rise from the sea and the sand to take shape as broken wall, shattered foundation, as arch and gate and dome. The ruins of Darth Vader's fortress retreat. The edifice hung in the air around and above Luke as it had once stood atop the cliff, dark-faced and forbidding. When it was done, the structure, securely perched just above the sand on pillars of stone extending down to the bedrock, Luke brought the E-Wing down the beach and nestled it in the chamber he had made for it. Once more, he addressed the droid. Shut down all systems, then place yourself in standby mode. I won't be needing you for a while. The last task was to inspect his retreat from the perspective of any outsiders whose gaze might fall upon it. All was as he had planned. From the sky, it appeared as part of the beach. From the sea, as part of the cliff. From the beach, as part of the sky. From the cliffs, as part of the sea. It was not a trick of camouflage, but a simple matter of allowing only the essences of these substances to be seen. May this sight remind me always that the few stones I've gathered will not last. And may the memory of Anakin Skywalker remind me always that surrender is more powerful than will. Then Luke descended into his retreat, sealing the opening behind him. The broad, curving windows of the staff conference room, high in the restored section of the Imperial Palace, looked out toward the oldest and busiest of the three spaceports serving Imperial City. Only the largest ships, the occasional crash landing and explosion, or a full-power launch aboard could be heard through the armored glass. So when the windows began to hum in sympathy with the sound beating on them from outside, both Leia and Akbar glanced up from their work to see why. A bright spherical shape, three times the size of an ordinary transport, was descending toward the spaceport. Three much smaller escorts circled it like planets around a star. Akbar watched with interest.
I believe that ship is using a radiant pulse lifter, undampered. Remarkable. Look how slow and steady the descent is.
It appears the Duskan delegation is finally here, Leia said. The transport settled on the ground, and the escorts disappeared one after another into a landing bay near the top of the sphere. Akbar turned to her.
Do you have meetings scheduled with Nilsfar?
In 10 days.
That long?
Nilsfar asked for the delay. He's never been to Coruscant before. He said he wants to explore a bit before negotiations occupy him. She reached out and pulled a data pad across the tabletop toward her.
Well, Admiral, now that it's operational, what shall we do with the Fifth Fleet?
Akbar turned his attention back to their previous topic of discussion.
A trickier question than I thought it would be. Tig Peramis has shown us what we can expect if there is even the appearance of gunboat diplomacy.
Leia frowned. I don't want us afraid to show the flag where it might help cooler heads prevail.
Then I would like to send the new fleet into the 7th security zone. I know of several worlds which would welcome even a short visit from a New Republic ship. For example, the Right Earl of Kalita Prime is appealing for help dealing with pirate raiders.
Good. Very good. Go ahead and put together a patrol itinerary for the 5th Fleet. Make sure it's heavy on tea parties and rescuing lost children. If there's anyone else in the 7th Security Zone who thinks the way Senator Peramis does, I want his fears put to rest. Waving their ID cards at the scanners, Han and Chewbacca entered the grounds of the presidential residence in full stride and in the middle of a full-blown argument.
I know, she's perfect. I know we couldn't have gotten her into that kind of shape in a year of weekends. So what? That's not my Falcon.
They had just left the shipyard where the Millennium Falcon had been turned into unrecognizable perfection by crews Han had entrusted to make some repairs. Han raised his hands in disgust.
I am not being unreasonable. How can you say that? That's right. Hardly a sound. She's as tight as a new boot. Hans stopped and turned on his friend. Listen, buddy, I hate new boots. I like my boots covered with scuffs, worn just this side of falling apart, with room for my toes and a little roll in the heels. All those noises they took out, that's how I used to know when I was pushing her. How am I going to know how hard we're hit next time we're in a scrap? I thought you'd understand. Chewy, they replaced the cushions on the acceleration couches. Don't they understand why people keep old furniture around the house? Feels like I'm sitting in somebody else's ship. I tell you, I'm going to have to take a whole day to go around with a wrench and start loosening things.
They found Leia on the back lawn, sitting on the grass with a data pad in her lap. Nearby, all three children lay side by side on their backs, with eyes closed or staring blankly upward. Han nodded toward the children as he sat down.
What'd you do to them? Kill them?
Jaina giggled at that, spoiling the effect. It's an exercise, Leia said. They're working on feeling the force flowing through the grass, through each separate plant, without disturbing the flow. It's one of the Jedi disciplines of moving lightly, leaving no sign. She spoke to the children. All right, children, that's enough. Three small bodies scrambled up from the grass and ran toward the vortex pool. Leia shielded her eyes.
Chewie, you look even taller than usual from down here.
Did you have as hard a time as my dear husband did, letting someone else work on his jalopy? Chewbacca crouched down on his heels with an easy balance that reminded Han his friend came from an arboreal planet. Well, of course, Chewie, go ahead, said Leia. Before Chewbacca had finished asking his question, Han sat up with a start, staring at him.
Go home? Go home?
Leia answered Chewbacca.
Of course. You have a family of your own, a mate and a child. Your responsibility to them is every bit as important as the obligations you feel toward us.
Tell him, Han.
Huh? Well, look, who's going to help me put the Falcon out of order again?
Han's eyes widened.
Oh, no, you can't ask me that. I just got her back after 167 days on the hook.
Han, dear, the least you could do is let him go back a hero in the ship both of you made famous.
I suppose.
Chewbacca crowed his delight and rushed forward to hug Han, who squirmed uncomfortably in the Wookiee's crushing embrace.
But you better take care of her. I want her back without a scratch, you hear me? Not a scratch. And fill the tanks before you leave Kashyyyk. I'm not paying for your conjugal visits.
Chewbacca gave a toothy grin and ruffled Han's hair. The unmarked office of Admiral Hiram Drayson lay buried inside five security perimeters and a curtain of misinformation and plausible deniability. The section he commanded had no publicly known name. The private name, Alpha Blue, was known only to the dozen officials with the very highest clearances and appeared nowhere in the government's or the military command's data records. The people Drayson commanded carried no Alpha Blue identification cards. They wore the insignia of a variety of unremarkable units, or, like Drayson himself, no insignia at all, and took their pay as quartermaster's mates and second gunners, ion mechanics and civilian clerks. Given that context, Drayson was just a little surprised the morning he entered his office and found someone already there, uninvited and unannounced, with his feet on Drayson's desk.
Well, Lando Calrissian, you're lucky I didn't shoot you.
Lando grinned.
I was counting on your being too curious how I got in to shoot me right away.
I said shoot you, not kill you. Blowing apart your knee would have been sufficient.
Now, please, get out of my chair.
Oh, if you insist. Lando vacated the chair with a flourish that left it slowly spinning.
Drayson folded his arms over his chest. So, what can I do for you?
Wrong question, Admiral. What can I do for you?
Pardon?
I'm bored. I go into business, I make a little money, I lose a little money. The game isn't interesting anymore. Someone throws a title at me, I pick up the pieces someone else dropped.
Till one day I realize I'm sitting behind a desk turning into you. There's no challenge in smuggling unless you want to go to the core, and I'm too smart to be that dumb. That's why I'm here. You're bored.
Exactly. Find something interesting for me to do.
General Lando Calrissian and Admiral Hiram Drayson, chief of Alpha Blue, stood before a large briefing screen studying a holoframe of a strange space vessel. Lando studied it at length before sighing in bewilderment.
I give up. I almost want to say it's Monmari construction, but I don't think they ever built anything that big. What is it?
The Teljikon Vagabond. Are you familiar with the legend of Another Chance?
Lando cocked an eyebrow questioningly.
The Alderaan Armory ship? Of course. Every smuggler in that sector has a story about seeing it, which means that every smuggler in that sector is a bald-faced liar.
You don't believe the legend, then?
Lando sighed deeply.
Oh, I wish it was true. I wish they'd recall Another Chance before the Death Star reached Alderaan. But it's just another shaggy ghost ship story.
Drayson reached out and tapped the surface of the screen.
I agree. But this is a real ghost ship. Probably the one that's kept the legend of Another Chance alive. This hollow was taken by the New Republic frigate Boldheart 5 years ago. Right afterward, Boldheart fired across the Vagabond's bow. The Vagabond fired back with some weapon we still don't understand, disabling Boldheart's engines with one shot. Then it jumped into hyperspace. It wasn't seen again for almost 2 years.
Bored yet?
No. Go on.
Admiral Drayson turned away from the briefing display.
That was actually the second documented sighting. The first to spot it was a monitor ship working the Teljikon system.
Thus, the name.
Right. The monitor ship took it for a derelict and tried to intercept it. Now, mind you, they'd been hailing it for hours, and not a peep in reply. Then the Vagabond broadcast a 5-second wide-spectrum modulation that nearly burned out every comm circuit on the monitor ship. There's a recording, but it's so distorted it's almost useless. Anyway, 30 seconds after it sent the signal...
Let me guess. Skipped into hyperspace.
On the numbers.
What about the third sighting?
That was ours. We thought we were going to be smart. An intelligence service ferret tried to attach a locator limpet to the Vagabond's hull. Never even got close.
Drayson leaned back in his chair and drummed his fingertips on the armrest.
It's in deep space, near Gamar Ascalon right now. We're trailing it with another ferret.
Keeping a safe distance, I hope.
Very safe. But we're going after it. Intelligence is putting together a small task force this very minute. They mean to catch the Vagabond, board it, and unravel the riddles. Colonel Pac-Picot of the Intelligence Service is in charge. I'd like to put you on his ship, nominally as fleet liaison.
Why me?
Because you think like a smuggler, and Pac-Picot thinks like a colonel. So, are you interested? Want to go chase the Teljikon Vagabond?
Lando just grinned. In the first quiet moment of the day, Han's comlink unit chirped at him.
Han, this is Luke. Will you come see me?
All right. Where are you? Leia had a dream about you last night. She says you're on Coruscant, are you?
Luke did not answer directly.
Take your speeder due west from Imperial City. When you reach the coast, turn off your nav system and release the controls. I'll bring you here.
A long-winged sea shrike rose from the rocks to fly in formation with Han's speeder. As slowing, it arrowed toward the beach. Han strained to make out where it might be headed. Then a hole opened in the sky. The sea shrike veered off, and the speeder coasted through the opening and settled on the floor of an otherwise empty, high-ceilinged chamber. Han twisted sideways in his seat to see where he had come from, just in time to watch the opening seal itself behind him.
Hello, Han, a voice said in his mind. Come on.
Han scrambled out of the speeder.
Come up. There's no...
As he began his protest, the nearest wall deformed into a ladder, and an opening appeared in the ceiling above it.
Sure, as if it would have been any more trouble to make stairs.
At the top of the ladder, he found himself standing in a large spherical room containing no furniture or technology, at least none that he could spot.
Now what?
Keep coming. Walk up the wall.
Easy for you to say.
But the opening Han climbed through had already vanished, leaving him with little choice. He started up the curving wall and found to his surprise that wherever he stood seemed to be the bottom of the sphere. After he had gone a dozen more tentative steps, a section of the floor, wall, ceiling, dropped away to form a ramp leading out of the sphere. He entered a large pyramidal room from one of its three sloping sides. It was as lacking in amenities as any space he had ever seen, and lit by a curious uniform glow that seemed to come from behind the walls. Han moved slowly toward the center of the room, looking up at the apex of the chamber.
Nice little treehouse. And you've done a wonderful job of cutting down on clutter. You'll have to give Leia the name of your decorator.
Thank you for coming, Han, a voice said behind him. It's good to see you. Han spun around and found Luke standing one long stride away. Han gave a lopsided grin.
Well, hey, I was in the neighborhood. What is this place?
Why are you here?
Why didn't you want Leia to come?
Leia wants something from me, Luke said. You don't.
Your other questions will take longer to answer.
Han looked around with a frown.
Now, this is going to be a long conversation. I don't suppose you have anything like a chair anywhere.
Luke dropped gracefully into a cross-legged meditation posture. Sit where you like, and I'll put an air cushion under you. He waited until Han was comfortably settled, then went on. As you see, I can hide well enough, even from Leia, but I'd rather be left alone. I hope you'll ask her to accept that.
I don't get it. Why?
Luke looked down into his lap before continuing. I don't know if you can understand or not. When I first met Obi-Wan, he'd been a hermit on Tatooine for 10 years or more. When I first met Yoda, he'd been a hermit on Dagobah for 100 years or more. At the time, I assumed they were both in hiding from the Emperor, from my father, but that makes no sense. No, I discovered the real reason while I was on Yavin. Han, the stronger you become in the Force, the more that's expected of you, and the less your life belongs to you.
Well, is this the answer, then?
Han gestured at the room.
Running away?
Call it that if you must. It's one answer. There's another, even less appealing. I'm convinced that for each Jedi, there comes a point at which he or she must choose. When the world presses in on you, threatens to drive you mad, there's only two ways you can find peace. One is to impose your will on everyone and everything around you. The other is to surrender your will and withdraw.
You know, Han said slowly, I always kind of wondered why you drew the short straw, why Yoda and Obi-Wan didn't team up and take on the Emperor themselves.
Luke's face lit up. Yes, I think that's why it fell to me, Han. That's why I had to be the one to face Vader. I still had the passion to reshape things, a passion Obi-Wan and Yoda had moved beyond.
Han frowned. What about now?
Luke shook his head. Now? I don't know if I could do it now. I don't know if I could summon the outrage. I feel myself standing at a cusp. I don't know what I should be doing with these gifts, these burdens. It's the question I've come here to explore. Han, will you help Leia understand?
I can try, Han said dubiously. She wants you to come live with us for a while. She needs help with the kids.
She thinks she does. I'm sorry, I have to say no. My sister has all the talent and wisdom she needs to be not only the mother, but the model your children need. She has only to believe in herself, and she'll find that nothing is beyond her. Which is why the worst thing I could do for your family right now is come to her rescue. The golden sheen of C-3PO's metal skin contrasted brilliantly with the broad green leaves and dangling vines of Yavin 4, through which the droid was noisily making his way.
Impossible! Such arrogance! For all he listens to me, you would think that he is the protocol droid and I the astromech.
Suddenly, the droid found his way blocked not only by Flora, but by a tall, broad-shouldered man in a military flight suit.
Oh!
C-3PO fell back a step.
General Calrissian, you startled me, sir. Where did you come from?
Lando grinned.
Don't tell me you're still fighting with R2 after all this time. You two are worse than brothers.
That stubborn contrary pile of tin is no brother to me. If I had been as carelessly constructed as he was, I would return myself to my maker to be scrapped. I could give you a list of his operational anomalies as long as...
That'll have to wait. Right now, the two of you need to pack your polish and power couplings. You're coming with me on a little trip.
Sir, I would be most delighted to accompany you, but Master Luke brought me here to Yavin to manage the administrative needs of the Academy.
Lando pursed his lips and considered.
Now, Luke's gone off on some sort of retreat, and he's assigned you to the fleet office until he returns, and the fleet office has assigned you to me. If I could have found Luke to ask him, I'm sure the end result would have been the same, Lando told himself.
Coppery clouds, rich in oxides of Tabana gas, churned outside the windows of what had once been Lando Calrissian's office in Bespin's Cloud City. Inside as outside, nothing had changed since the last time he had seen it. The walls and shelves were heavily laden with the eclectic collection of objects that only a rich man or a well-traveled smuggler could amass.
I like what you've done to the place,
Lando said to the cyborg that sat behind what had once been Lando's desk.
I guess I never did get around to sending for my things, eh?
I don't mind, said Lobot.
The activity lights on the interface band he wore from ear to ear were flickering busily.
You have better judgment in subjective matters than I do. The calculus of room decorations still eludes me.
Lando grinned.
Well, at least you have the good taste to recognize my good taste. Still, a man can get tired of the same surroundings day after day. Lobot, you work too hard. You're long overdue for a change of scenery. A vacation.
Lobot frowned.
But systems will randomize without monitoring and supervision.
Then think about how much fun you'll have putting them right when you get back. And knowing how much you like work, I cooked up a vacation where there'll be plenty of work for you to do.
The Teljikon Armada, 7 vessels in all, had gathered in orbit around the 6th planet of the Coruscant system, where it would not readily attract attention. The Lady Luck was the last to join them, and the smallest ship among them, save for a pilotless intelligence ferret. Lando's yacht was dwarfed by Pakpakat's command ship, the cruiser Glorious. On board, Lando and the droids were escorted to the captain's office. Lando was unprepared for the man who turned to the bridge's aft blast door, where Lando stood with his specially picked team.
Curse you, Drayson, you could have told me he was a Hortek,
he thought reflexively, when he saw the 2-meter-tall Hortek with bony, ruddy-brown armor plates.
But then Lando guarded his thoughts as best he could. Besides being one of the few predator species in the New Republic, the Hortek had the reputation of being telepathic.
General,
Pakpakat said, curtly acknowledging Lando. His gaze flicked to Lobot and the droids.
Who are these people?
C-3PO stepped forward smartly.
Sir, I am C-3PO, human-cyborg relations. I am fluent in over 6 million...
Lando stepped forward.
Colonel Pakpakat, this is my staff. I'd be happy to make introductions, but I have some late updates for you, which perhaps ought to have our attention first. Is your ready room available?
Pakpakat held his head high, studying Lando.
Reaching into my mind, you and I need to talk, and no one else here needs to hear what we say.
The moment the door wrapped privacy around them, Pakpakat made a sharp barking sound, the Hortek equivalent of a grunt.
I was told to wait for an observer from Fleet Command. Nothing was said about staff.
Why should anything need to be said? Do you go anywhere without your aides? And I expect them to be extended every consideration due me as the Fleet Officer's field operative for this mission.
Pakpakat moved closer, looming over Lando.
Operative! Now, that's a curious word, General. Exactly what are you asking?
No more than you would. Run of the ship. Full and timely access to tactical data. Consultation on strategy. And if and when we board her, include us in.
The Hortex showed his teeth.
Do you take me for wounded prey?
We are prepared to assemble an assault team tailored to whatever challenges the Vagabond presents.
Do you have a lockpick?
What?
You said you're prepared, but it's been my experience that when someone in uniform says that, he really means we have little guns, we have big guns, we have bombs of all sizes. There are other ways to get past the locked door. Are you as ready to pick a lock as you are to blow one up? As ready to wheedle as you are to demand? As ready to coax as to capture? We've beaten tricks your people haven't even thought of yet.
Pakpikot's nostrils flared.
Very well. We will work together. But I will be watching you.
Lando kept his mind clear.
We're going to get along just fine, Colonel. You'll see.
On the morning of her first meeting with Nilspar, Leia climbed out of bed with tired eyes and a fatigue in her limbs that made her feel as if she were on the verge of being ill. Her grogginess persisted through breakfast. As she dressed for her meeting with the Viceroy of the Duskan League, she thought only about falling back into bed for a nap. The temptation got stronger once she reached the final briefing. The conference room seemed to be full of bodies, and everyone seemed to be talking to her at once.
Almost everything we know about the Kurnacht cluster is 30 years old. It was in Imperial hands from the time of the Clone Wars until shortly after the Battle of Endor. The Empire didn't allow anyone in, and until now the Yavetha haven't seemed interested in coming out.
As near as we can tell, the Duskan League only includes the 11 worlds populated by the Yavetha. We believe that there are as many as 17 worlds in the Kurnacht cluster that are populated by other species, and not part of the Duskan League.
Intelligence hasn't been able to find a single civilian pilot who'll admit to having gone into the Kurnacht cluster.
Why doesn't intelligence have better information for us? Where does a viceroy stand in the Duskan power structure?
I don't think there's any question but that Nilspar represents more worlds, a larger population, greater material riches, and a more advanced industrial technological base than anyone who's come to Imperial City in the last 12 years. And he probably knows it, too.
Leia, from a strategic standpoint, it sure would be nice to have a friend that big sitting between us and whatever Admiral Dalla's doing in the Corps. Right now, Kurnacht is one of the soft spots along the inner line.
Shaking her head, Leia pushed herself away from the table and started toward the door. Lightheadedness halted her steps halfway across the room. As she swayed unsteadily, Admiral Akbar hastened to her side and took her arm.
"Help me to my office," she whispered.
In the privacy of the President's suite, Akbar helped Leia settle on a thickly padded couch.
"What is happening to you?" Akbar asked. "Should I signal the medical droid?"
"No. I'll be all right. I just want to lie down for a few moments. There was no air in that conference room."
"You don't look well. Do you want to postpone?"
She shook her head almost imperceptibly.
"No. No, it would just complicate things. Nilspar expects to meet in private with the Chief of State of the New Republic. That's what he insisted on. That's what we agreed to. We can't make any changes an hour before the session without giving offense."
Leia closed her eyes. "Just go away and let me have a few minutes of quiet. I'll be ready when the time comes. This isn't a crisis. Everything will be fine."
In a subtle bit of choreography arranged by the protocol attachés for both sides, Princess Leia Organa Solo, President of the New Republic, and Nilspar, Viceroy of the Duskan League, entered the Grand Hall from opposite sides at exactly the same moment. Leia's strides were measured and steady.
She had spent some time alone in meditation, opening her connection to the Force and drawing on its deep, powerful current, allowing the flow to cleanse and refresh her body and mind. Nilspar matched her pace, stride for stride. His eyes were strikingly human, distracting Leia at first from the high ruff of armor at the back of his neck and the bold streaks of facial color that disappeared under the soft swirl of fabric he wore on his head. His gaze was open and friendly, his smile disarming. The Yevathan was dressed as he had been on the streets in all the surveillance recordings Leia had seen, in a close-fitting, long-sleeved brown tunic, narrow-legged pants tucked into his boots, and beige gloves that disappeared up the sleeves of his tunic. By unspoken agreement, each of them stopped when the other was a long stride out of arm's reach. "Viceroy?" Leia said, and bowed.
"Princess Leia." Nilspar bowed in turn. "I am so pleased to be here with you. This is how it should be. You, the head of a confederacy of worlds, strong, proud, prosperous. Me, the head of a confederacy of worlds, strong, proud, prosperous. You have welcomed me as an equal, and I welcome you in the same fashion."
"Thank you, Viceroy. Would you like to sit?" Leia gestured toward two chairs, which faced each other in the middle of the room.
"By all means."
Nilspar seated himself.
"How pleased I would be if we should be able to forge an alliance which will benefit those we love."
"That's the entire purpose of the New Republic." Leia deliberately sidestepped the word alliance as if it were quicksand. "I think that if you'll speak to the leaders of some of the 100 worlds which have become members in the last 28 days, you'll hear that the benefits are substantial and immediate."
"I do not doubt it. One need only look at the miracle of Coruscant. Was it not but half a dozen years ago that this world was ravaged by the clone emperor himself?"
"Yes."
"And now I find it rebuilt from its own ashes to a new glory that rivals the stories of old. And there are so many of you. I'm certain I saw more different species in my first hour here than I did in my entire previous life. How does it all work? Is membership political or genetic?"
"The New Republic is a mutual self-protection pact among over 400 sentient species, and an economic partnership between 11,000 inhabited worlds. But you'll find that the autonomy of member worlds is hardly compromised at all."
"So long as they are willing to be cooperative and tolerant."
Puzzled, Leia felt as though the ground had suddenly shifted under her. "I don't think a legation has ever come to Coruscant expecting to be anything else. And since you raised the issue, would you mind telling me why you and your legation are here?"
"Not at all. As impressed as I am with your ideas, your capital city, and your confederation, the Duskin League is not interested in membership in the New Republic, not collectively and not as individual worlds. What I seek is an agreement between equals, to the benefit of both."
Leia frowned. I think you should know right now that it'll be very hard for us to come to an agreement between equals that'll allow us to respond militarily if you're threatened."
Truly, you do not yet understand. We do not want or need your protection. We enjoyed the protection of the Empire for half my lifetime, and we are determined to avoid such blessings in the future. What we want, more than anything, is to be left alone. Bear that in mind, and we may begin to speak the same language."
For the next hour, they worked at teasing out what the language of alliance might sound like. Despite apparent good faith, they constantly stumbled over conflicting assumptions, and their progress was hard to measure. But at midday, when the Viceroy gathered himself and stood, he pronounced,
"This has been valuable and enjoyable. Shall we resume in 1 hour?"
"I'd be happy to continue through lunch. We could have food brought to us."
Nilspar looked momentarily shocked.
"With all apologies,
That is not possible. My people hold it a great affront to propriety to take food in mixed company.
My apologies. In an hour, then.
The debriefing session included Leia, Admiral Akbar for the Fleet Office, Admiral Drayson standing in for Intelligence Director General Rikan, Chairman Ben Kilnam for the Senate, First Administrator Eng, two recorder droids, and half a dozen senior aides. Everyone listened without interruption as Leia recounted her conversation with Nilspar. Drayson was the first to respond.
According to the Viceroy, it's been 9 years since the occupation ended. I don't think we can guess how extensively they may have rearmed. That ship sitting over at Eastport certainly testifies to their engineering abilities.
I don't think it matters, Leia said. There's no question in my mind that they feel threatened by us. I think it's critical that we give them reason not to be.
If they do feel threatened, that should provide you with useful leverage, said Ben Kilnam.
I'm not looking for leverage. That's the wrong tone for these talks.
As the meeting came to a close, Drayson asked if he might speak with Leia in private. When they were alone, he spoke solemnly.
I'm concerned about the fact that all your advisors must rely on second-hand reports. It makes it difficult for them to provide you with the independent counsel you expect from them.
What are you suggesting?
That I arrange for more eyes and ears in the room with you. I could provide you with a burst transmission comlink, small enough that even General Solo would be hard-pressed to find it.
I don't expect to be frisked by the Viceroy, Leia said curtly. And I won't take the chance of confirming their worst fears by being caught spying.
The Yvathan ground skimmer that picked up Nilspar in the bowels of the Imperial City Administrative Complex discharged him a few minutes later in the embassy ship Aramedia. As soon as the hatch closed behind him, Nilspar found himself in a sanitary entry station. Quickly removing his clothing, he dropped it into a sterile incinerator. Then he stepped into the scrub chamber. With eyes closed, he invoked the needle spray showers. First the gentle rain of the fumigant, then the agonizing bite of the scrub jets. Then he passed through the inner door, where waiting hands draped his body in a fire-blue gown.
Viceroy,
the attaché said, bowing.
Nilspar accepted the heavy silver viceroy's neck guard and fastened it in place.
Thank you, Eri. I must resign myself to it. Their vermin stink never leaves my nostrils, no matter how long I stay in the scrub chamber.
An air cart whisked him up 11 levels to the domain of Vordur, Proctor of Information Science for the Aramedia. Nilspar greeted him.
Were you able to receive a signal?
Without interruption.
Nilspar nodded.
What do you think of them?
They seem to me weak, gullible, eager to please. She is no match for you.
The data card that Admiral Hiram Drayson dropped into the data pad on his desk looked for all the world like a standard universal data exchange card, but the cards used by Alpha Blue for sensitive information had a non-standard encoding, which made the card appear blank when placed in a standard data pad. It could even be erased and reformatted without destroying the information it bore. In this case, excerpts from a recording made earlier that day by a tiny audio telescope concealed in the ornate scrollwork on the ceiling of the Great Hall. He listened.
I think you should know right now that it'll be very hard for us to come to an agreement between equals that'll allow us to respond militarily if you're threatened.
Drayson thought as he listened. I wish you'd chosen to let us into that room with you, Princess. But I'll do all I can to make certain you don't look back on that choice with regret. Inside the protective cocoon of Luke Skywalker's secret hermitage, time had no meaning. Sealed behind windowless walls, he lived in darkness for days at a time, barely conscious of hunger, thirst, or other bodily demands. The winds howled outside the hermitage, but Luke was oblivious to them. His solitude was complete, timeless, and undisturbed. Then a visitor came, and everything changed. It was his ordinary senses reawakened that informed Luke of another presence. First a sound, which he later realized was his own name. A woman stood in the chamber with him, half a dozen steps away. Her shoulders were bare, her throat covered by a scarf that vanished down her back. Her hair was long and braided, her clothing soft and flattering. Her eyes were dark, intent, and knowing. He took her at first for a projection, because it was unthinkable that anyone could have passed through the walls without alerting him, but then he touched her bare arm and knew she was real. "Explain yourself," he said. "You are him. You are Luke, son to Anakin." She smiled with delight. "Forgive me. I thought I would never find you."
"Where did you come from?"
"From Karatos," she said, naming a planet in a system 40 parsecs from Coruscant. As rudely as his visitor had invaded his hermitage, Luke suddenly invaded her mind, probing the secret place where sensitivity to the Force resided. If she possessed the sort of talent her actions claimed for her, he should be thrown halfway across the room when her reflex repelled his mental touch. It was so with every Jedi he had probed, every candidate he had brought to Yavin for training. Luke's probing met no resistance. He felt no shields blunting or deflecting his exam. But still, she had found him. "Who are you?" he asked. She laughed. "Forgive me. I am Akana of the Phalanasi, an adept of the White Current."
"I'm afraid I don't know your people or that path."
"I know. You won't find us in your senses, or the Emperor's, or the Old Republic's. It's not our way to claim lands and raise flags. But you should know us. That's part of why I've come."
Luke was puzzled. "If your people are such ciphers, why should I know you?"
"Because your mother is one of us, Luke Skywalker."
Luke stared. "My mother? Are you saying my mother might be alive?"
"I don't know. Who saw her fall? Where is her grave? I wish I could answer your question, but I don't even know my own mother's fate. I've been separated from the body of my people for too many years."
"Separated? Why?"
"I was away when the Empire came to the world we called home then. The Phalanasi had to take flight because they would not let themselves and their gifts be used for violence and evil. I don't blame them. I know they must have waited for me as long as they could. That was 19 years ago. I was 12. Not much more than a child."
"And you never found them again?" There was a touch of suspicion in Luke's voice. "You found me."
She smiled tolerantly. "The Phalanasi are more practiced at hiding than you are, Luke Skywalker. And there isn't much an abandoned child can do in the middle of a war to search for a family that doesn't want to be found."
"So, you're looking for them now? And you say my mother could be with them?" He shook his head. "My mother. She's been such a mystery to me my whole life, I don't even know her name."
"She may have had other names, many of us do, but she is known as Nashira. I've come here to ask you to go away with me and help me find our people so that you and I can both be whole again."
"I don't know who you are. I don't know that anything you've said is true."
"Then I will tell you some things that you know are true. Your father was lost to the dark side, and you were forced to try to kill him. Perhaps that is why you cannot let yourself love without fear. Perhaps that is why you have no children of your own. You must fear that someday you will find yourself ready to kill your own son, and him ready to kill you."
"No."
"You must fear yourself. How could you not, having walked the path you have? The bond that links you to all the horrors of Darth Vader's reign is a terrible burden. Is that not why you're here?"
Luke shook his head. "No.
You can't know that. I've voiced those fears to no one. No one.
Akana glided closer. They're written in your eyes and lie heavy on your spirit. You'd see them yourself, but for the blindness we all have when we look in a mirror. Their eyes met. Luke felt her gaze like a light cast into the dark corners of his psyche. She had taken down all his shields, and he was defenseless against her.
Will you come with me, Luke Skywalker?
I don't know. There's something I must do first. Someone I need to tell.
Leia?
Yes. Will you wait here while I go see her?
Of course. I've waited long enough for this night. I can wait a little longer for our journey to begin.
Without warning, Leia sat bolt upright in bed, breaking Han's embrace.
He's coming here tonight.
Who is?
Luke. She threw back the sheet and climbed out of bed. He's coming to see us.
Leia ran out to meet Luke on the garden trail as soon as the E-Wing sat down. She kissed his cheek and took his arm.
I knew you'd come.
Leia, I may have some new information about our mother.
What new information? Where does it come from?
I don't want to tell you yet. I'm hoping you'll let me probe your mind again first. I have an idea what to look for now. Her body language foretold her answer. She held herself back from him, arms wrapped around herself, her mouth hard, her eyes angry.
No. Go back to wherever you came from.
She turned abruptly and started back toward the residence. Luke found her in the kitchen, sitting on a stool at the meal bar, cupping a tall glass in both hands and staring out the window.
This is important for both of us, Leia.
For your children, too. Luke's glance acknowledged Han, who was standing in the doorway, leaning against the frame. I think there really might be a chance to break through and discover our mother as a real person.
Why?
Leia turned toward him, and he saw the weariness in her eyes.
You've probed me more times than I can remember. You had R2 and 3PO on Obra Skye for months searching the libraries for any clue.
She emptied her glass and set it down on the bar.
You and I sat in a Jedi meditation circle for hours on end, night after night, calling on Obi-Wan and Anakin and Yoda, Owen and Beru, my foster parents, anyone we knew of who might have known her. Calling her, too. Remember?
I remember.
You're obsessed with the past. It's been 14 years, Luke, and we're not hard to find. At least I'm not.
But there might be reasons we don't know of for her not to come to us. She may need to protect those who protected her.
She's dead, Luke. You and I are foundlings. That's how it is, like it or not. Our family tree starts here, with this family and these children. So you do what you think you have to, brother. Go chase whatever shadow of a clue you like. I don't care about any of it. Don't ask for my help again. And don't bring the past into this house. I've had enough of it for 10 lifetimes.
Like most small sports spacecraft with bold names, Akana's Verpine Adventurer offered few amenities, technical or personal. It had no weapons, combat shields, or astromech droid, and its sublight speed rating was a meager 2.5. But the pilot station was roomy enough for Luke to forego his service flight suit in favor of looser, more casual clothing, and the small cargo hold had more than room enough for his one modest bag, beside Akana's luggage and supplies. After ordering the R-71 droid to destroy the hermitage if anyone should breach the perimeter, Luke climbed in beside Akana.
Our destination is Lukazik, she said as they buckled themselves in. That was our last home. We'll start our search there.
In deep space, far from any star, the Teljikon Vagabond drifted in the darkness, silent and inert. Trailing well behind was the much smaller black-hulled intelligence ferret IX-44F, one ghost shadowing another. The ferret was nearly as inert as its quarry. It announced itself only with periodic position updates broadcast to Coruscant by Hypercom, and by an optical laser pulse aimed directly aft. Following the ferret's beacon, Pakpakat's armada had taken days to close the gap, its slow, silent approach that of an infinitely patient predator. Spreading out in intercept formation were the three spotter ships, two escorts, and the Lightning, a converted Pranawe racer, assigned to make complete recordings of the intercept attempt. If the vagabond tried to run in normal space, it was Lightning's job to run with it. The cruiser Glorious, the gunship Marauder, and the pilotless ferret D-89 closed with the shadowing ferret so slowly that at times an impatient Lando thought they would never reach it.
"We've gone far beyond prudent," he grumbled to Lobot. "I'm beginning to suspect the Hortek hunt by boring their prey to death."
But finally, the hour came when all 10 ships were in position. IX-44F and its 3-man crew were relieved to return to base, and the Glorious took up its position.
"What do you think is inside, General Calrissian?"
asked Pakpakat as they stood together at the main bridge viewport.
"Why is it here? Where is it going? Have you and your staff made any progress on the signal fragment from the initial monitor ship contact?"
"Colonel, you know our hands have been tied by your blackout orders," Lando said. "We've had hardly any bandwidth available to us on the hypercom. Lady Luck doesn't have the kind of data capacity you have here on Glorious."
"I will take that as a report of no progress."
With a light touch on the main viewport's controls, Pakpakat sharpened the outline and detail of the vagabond.
"Look at it, General. For all we know, it may be 500 years old, or 50,000. Do you know that no ship like this appears in any registry of any New Republic world? As far as we know, no other like it was ever made."
"Our catalog of everything that ever was is a long way from being complete. The odds favor a less exotic history."
"How can a gambler post the odds without knowing the game?" "We will watch them for a while. We'll let them watch us for a while as well. Can you live with that, General?"
Lando's skin prickled to hear echoes of his private impatience in Pakpakat's words.
"For now, Colonel. I just hope whoever or whatever's inside that thing isn't busy making plans to destroy it to keep it out of our hands."
Pakpakat's expression was unreadable.
"I will ask the communications officer to allot what slack time there may be in our hypercom queue to your staff. Perhaps that will allow you to make faster progress."
Lando replied with courtly politeness.
"Thank you, Colonel. That'd be a step in the right direction."
Lieutenant Norda Proy of the New Republic Fleet studied the high-resolution scan of space directly ahead of her ship, the Steadfast. The 3D display showed more than 12,000 objects, from hundreds no larger than a stormtrooper's combat boot, to one that promised to be the aft third of an Imperial Star Destroyer. What a mess. Must have been one wild party. For nearly a year, the fleet hauler Steadfast had traced a solitary course through what had once been Imperial space. Their mission orders took them to the coordinates of major battles between the Empire and its enemies, where they searched through the wreckage for objects or information of potential value.
"I have a positive identification on the wreck, Lieutenant,"
a junior intelligence officer called out. "It's the I-class star destroyer Nisnau, reported destroyed by internal explosions." Norda Proy nodded.
"All right, let's move in."
First aboard the wreck were half a dozen scanning and monitoring droids. Working in pairs so anything that happened to one would be documented by the other, the droids fanned out according to a search plan tailored to that class of vessel. At a console in Steadfast's forward hold, the crew monitored the steady stream of images and sensor data the droids sent back. On the screen, they could see more than 40 workstations, their displays shattered, arrayed in two half-circles. All faced a 2-meter-tall metallic cylinder, which stood on a platform against the far wall. On either side of the cylinder were digital display panels as wide as blast doors, an ever-changing array of multicolored messages in basic and binary filled most of the face of the left panel. Awed, Proy took a deep breath.
By my mother's jewels. What is it?
The intelligence officer asked. Our return ticket to Coruscant. An intact Imperial memory core. Back on Coruscant, five different teams, made up of crack information science specialists, aided by speedy analysis droids, immediately set out to find the patterns in the gibberish code of the memory core. Team 3 assembled the first fragmentary string, made up of the names and ranks of two of Nisnal's command officers. Within a day, Team 5 had found an even longer string containing a standard Imperial Hypercom message header. The final breakthrough belonged to Team 3 again. The complete 15-point standing maintenance order for a TIE bomber. Its more than 1,400 sequential data bits seemed to map every detail of the new algorithm. Confirmation came quickly. An interface droid was programmed with the new algorithm and linked to the Nisnal core. And this time, tens of thousands of object and data files poured forth. Each file was copied, tagged, classified, and forwarded to the analysis section for distribution. One of them, given the ID number AK-031-995 and a priority code of most urgent, ended up in the hands of Idadar Nylikirka, whose assignment was asset tracking. Nylikirka soon realized that in the entire history of the asset tracking office, no one had ever had available what he now had before him. A complete Imperial order of battle. It was all there. Every warship by name, class, call sign, and commander, assigned to every fleet and combat command, every stormtrooper company and infantry battalion assigned to every transport, occupation force, outpost, and fort, every cripple in a dry dock and every keel in a shipyard with projected repair and completion dates. It was a treasure beyond price. The order of battle encompassed information far beyond what ordinary ship captains and task force commanders would have at their disposal. Information that only a ranking sector commander or the Emperor's own military aides would possess. Idadar Nylikirka did not leave his desk for 3 days. When, at last, he did, it was not to go home. With his data pad tucked tightly under his arm, he headed for Victory Lake and the home of Admiral Akbar. The track outside the officers' gymnasium at Fleet Headquarters wound its way for a kilometer over hilly, wooded ground. Secured, shielded, and privacy-screened, it had been used many times for discreet, deniable meetings. Not least by the man for whom Admiral Akbar waited in the cool morning air. As the runner drew near, Akbar stepped out from the trees.
"I see you are still a creature of habit, Hiram,"
he said with cheerful gruffness. Admiral Hiram Drayson slowed from his brisk jog to a walk.
"I see you're still as slothful as ever. It's been a long time since you've been in the gym."
Akbar fell in beside Drayson.
"I do not much enjoy coming here, but sometimes I have no choice. Will you take pity and walk with me a while?"
"I think I can accommodate myself to your pace. What's new?"
"I had a visit last night from the senior analyst of asset tracking. He has been studying the Imperial Order of Battle taken from the Nisnal a month ago. He has found a discrepancy."
"Another katana?"
"Nothing so large or clear-cut. What the young man has discovered is this. There are an unusual number of vessels assigned to the Empire's Black Sword Command that we cannot account for."
"Black Sword Command defended the center of the Empire's Rim territories."
"Yes."
Akbar gasped for breath. He placed a hand on Drayson's shoulder.
"Please, may we stop? The older I get, the harder it is for me to keep my lungs wet in air."
Drayson stopped and faced the Admiral.
"Of course. You were saying?"
"According to the analyst, the order of battle for Black Sword includes 44 capital ships, which we have not seen nor heard of since the fall of the Emperor. None smaller than a Victory-class Star Destroyer. 3 are super-class vessels."
Drayson whistled. "What do you think of his analysis?"
"I find it
indisputable. You know that that's more than enough firepower to overwhelm any planetary system in the New Republic, Coruscant included.
Yes. If those ships still exist, they represent a serious threat.
If.
You see, there are many wrinkles to this matter. All but 5 of the 44 were either newly laid keels or in a yard somewhere for refit or major repairs.
Which yards?
We cannot say. The names given are either not known to us or are code names for places we do know. But what I am concerned about is that the Empire preferred to establish military shipyards in every sector they controlled, so that no one facility was critical to the war effort and damaged ships did not need to travel far for repairs.
Drayson frowned.
Which would suggest that those unidentified yards were likely located somewhere in Black Sword Command's patrol area.
And that would mean that as many as 20 Star Destroyers could be very much closer to us than the Corps. There are large areas of Kokash and Farlax which have never been properly surveyed, including the Morath Nebula and the Kurnacht Cluster.
Ah, said Drayson. I see where this is leading.
Hiram, I don't want to know how you might know the answers, but I know you have resources not available outside your office. I'm worried about this business with Nilspar. Negotiations have been at a standstill for weeks, and yet Leia still urges patience. And I wonder to myself, could the Yevetha be hiding these ships? Is it possible the Duskan League is still allied with the Corps?
After a moment's measured consideration, Drayson said,
I have no information to support such a thesis, or to rule it out.
Then I am at a loss as to how to proceed. The negotiations in progress make this a delicate matter. I cannot make accusations without evidence, nor can I ignore a potential threat of this magnitude.
What would you do if the decision were yours?
I believe we should begin a search for this Black Fleet. We must know the fate of these ships.
Drayson nodded thoughtfully. And I think you should take this information to Princess Leia and make that recommendation. Perhaps she'll allow you to persuade her.
Akbar sighed.
I fear otherwise. Still, I can but try.
He then pressed a data card into Drayson's hand.
The list of the missing ships.
Princess Leia turned away from the broad transparisteel of the executive conference room to face Admiral Akbar and General Abbott, the commander of the Fifth Fleet. Let me make sure I understand. No one has seen any of these vessels for 10 years, and that's why you're worried about them?
Akbar and Abbott exchanged looks, negotiating who would answer. Akbar lost.
Essentially, that is correct.
Why doesn't that sound as silly to you as it does to me? No one is going to attack the New Republic.
Both Akbar and Abbott were stunned by her pronouncement.
If you're so sure of that, then let's mothball the fleet and muster out the troops,
Abbott said scornfully.
I'm sure we all have better things we could be doing.
General, it's because of the fleet that no one's going to attack us. Akbar tells me we can now call on more ships than fought on both sides in the largest battle of the rebellion.
Yes, Princess, but there is more to consider, Akbar said forcefully. If this Black Fleet exists, and if it is operational, it represents a secret weapon. And it is the nature of secret weapons to upset all the careful planning of one's adversaries.
Leia sighed. I really don't need this right now. What exactly are you recommending?
General Abbott answered.
Princess, the Fifth Fleet is about to sail on its show-the-flag excursion. I would suggest to you that searching for the Black Fleet would be a better use of those ships.
You realize, of course, that the Kurnacht Cluster is in Farlax.
Akbar nodded.
Yes, of course.
Then you realize you'll have to exempt Kurnacht from any search. Nilspar has been adamant about territorial integrity. Their claim extends to the entire cluster. Once again, Akbar and Abbat exchanged glances. This time, Abbat lost.
Princess, perhaps you can explain to me the logic in starting a search and announcing a safe hiding place at the same time.
Akbar said there are over 200 inhabited worlds in that region, Leia said. That should give you enough to keep you busy until I've reached an agreement with the Avetha. As her next meeting with Nilspar was drawing to a close, Leia said, Viceroy, before we recess for the day, I wonder if you might be able to satisfy my curiosity on a historical matter. Nilspar bowed his head.
If I can, Princess, I am not an historian.
When the Empire occupied the League worlds, did they establish any shipyards there?
Oh, yes, several of them. This history I am well acquainted with. We Avetha are skilled in matters of making. It is a gift of our very being. But the Empire turned our gifts into a curse. Thousands of my people were forced to work as slaves to repair the very machines that were used to oppress us and to wage war on your rebellion.
When the Empire left Kurnacht,
they took all that they could with them and destroyed what they could not, killing more than 6,000 Yavetha in the process. It was one final act of savagery to end a reign of cruelty. But tell me, Princess, how is it that you ask this question?
My defense advisors have become concerned about the possibility of old Imperial capital ships in the patrol area of the Black Sword Command, Farlax and Hatawa. It's more a matter of bookkeeping than anything else, but I've had to give my permission for some further investigation.
Your advisors are only prudent to insist on it. Tell me, how many ships are they seeking?
44. Viceroy, I can't offer you anything but my goodwill, but you could be of great help to me in what should be a small matter. If you could ask your historians to look at the list of missing ships and relay what you can about the fate of any that may have been in Kurnacht.
You ask us to revisit old unpleasantries. Nevertheless, my mission is to protect my people. If I can help put the fears of your advisors to rest, then I am serving that duty. Give me the list. I will transmit it to the Proctor of Records and Antiquities.
Akbar wheezed for breath as he walked along the cinder track beside Drayson.
I want you to know, Admiral, that I do not plan to make a habit of idle exercise.
I thought you should know that Leia gave him the list.
What?
At the third session this evening.
She should not have done that.
Akbar said darkly.
What could she be thinking?
In effect, she asked him to search his own pockets, so the fifth doesn't have to frisk him.
Akbar shook his head.
How foolish of her. There's one bright spot to consider, though, when he transmits that list home. We should finally be able to break their encryption key.
Things did not work out as planned. After Nilspar and Leia's meeting the next morning, Drayson reported to Admiral Akbar, revealing the Yavathan's deception. Though Nilspar assured Leia that all the ships on the list had been destroyed in the shipyards, Drayson knew he never transmitted the list home. So, you see, we can go back to the original plans for the Fifth Fleet, Leia explained patiently to Admiral Akbar. This needlessly provocative mission to Hatawa and Farlax isn't necessary. There's no Black Fleet hiding there. Admiral Akbar scanned the list of ships and handed it to General Abbat, sitting to his right at the great conference table.
Princess, I do not believe this changes anything. It is my intention that General Abbat carry out the search mission as planned.
Leia's face showed open surprise. I don't understand, Admiral. I'm satisfied that the Viceroy's word is good.
Why?
Challenged Abbat.
Because you like him. Have you led such a sheltered life that you've never been lied to by someone you liked before?
General,
Akbar said reprovingly.
Princess, I must remind you that you are the one who agreed to meet with him alone. We are at a disadvantage in judging his motives, but that is not the issue.
What is?
Whether we are ready to accept that we are now a great power. Princess, a third of that region is now aligned with the Republic. Another third or more is unclaimed, uninhabited, or under dispute. Even if you accept the Duskan hegemony over all of Cornacht, they control barely a tenth of the region. We have every right to be there.
Because no government there can stop us? Demanded Leia. Is that the morality you think the New Republic should be following? You sound more like an advisor to the Emperor.
Leia, we must follow our own principles or they are meaningless, said Akbar. Under Article 11 of the Charter, we proclaim a principle of free navigation. Both interstellar space and hyperspace are owned by none and open to all. We recognize no territorial claims beyond the boundaries of a single star system. Do you believe in the principle of free navigation?
Of course.
Then there is no precedent for the Duskan League's claim to an entire star cluster. I am willing to accept that we will choose not to enter Cornacht at this time. I am not willing to accept that we have no right to go there.
It's what the Duskan League is willing to accept that matters here.
Not more than our principles, said Abbott, and not more than our own security. The idea that we should stay away from Tharlax because it might upset the Yavetha is absurd.
Leia's eyes flashed dark anger. General, you sound like you don't care about the possibility of alienating the Duskan League.
I'm afraid the General is right, said Akbar. We cannot sacrifice our freedom of action simply to please a would-be ally. If you do not agree to let the fleet's orders stand, you will have to find someone to replace me. I cannot continue without your confidence.
Leia closed her eyes and bowed her head slightly. Searching her heart, she could not find the strength to resist Akbar's earnest certainty. Very well. The orders stand. Han Solo knew that something was up when Leia came back to their residence in the middle of the afternoon, but he could never have guessed what she would ask him. Han, I need you to go with the Fifth Fleet on this mission.
What? That's crazy.
It's a bot. I don't know if he really accepts my authority. There isn't anything I can point to justify it. I'm just not sure what he'll do when he's on his own out there.
Why me?
You're the only person I trust completely. And you have all the necessary clearances in place. Han glowered.
He's going to expect me to be in full uniform. I'm going to have to shave every morning.
I know I'm asking a lot, Han. The chances are it'll be a long, boring deployment. I hope it will be.
So why am I going?
Just in case I don't get my wish.
For 22 days, Colonel Peck Picot's little armada had flown station with the Teljikon Vagabond. In all that time, the mystery ship had done nothing to acknowledge their presence. The armada had done its own part to preserve the silence. No messages had been sent to the Vagabond. No active scanners had painted it with energy. No ship had approached closer than 15 kilometers. All that was about to end. The pilotless ferret D-89 had a mission: to breach the perimeter as unaggressively as possible. According to the plan, the ferret would be inside the Vagabond's defense perimeter for less than a second. If the alien vessel tried to jump into hyperspace, the interdiction pickets would be ready to stop it. In the control room, Lando and Colonel Peck Picot watched the numbers roll by as the ferret approached its target. Suddenly, the bridge's speakers began blasting out a wildly modulated sound. It could not be called musical, though there was no other ready word to describe it. To Lando, the sound was both familiar and new. It was the same as the initial monitor ship recording, but much more distinct,
For the first time, he could tell that there were two melody lines, something that only signal analyzers had been able to detect before. The signal abruptly ceased. Its job done, D-89 continued out of the intercept area and off the bridge display. Almost at the instant D-89's tracking circle vanished, a brilliant white flash filled all three sections of the display so intensely that those looking that way were left momentarily blinded. When the flash faded, the vagabond was gone from the lightning feed and suddenly smaller in the magnified view.
What was that?
Hackbacott demanded. Target jumped, but the field held it in real space, said his navigator. Target has moved ahead about 3 kilometers. They waited nearly an hour before deciding that nothing else was going to happen. Then Pakpakot ordered the spotter ships to move up and had Glorious brought back to its accustomed position, trailing 15 clicks behind the vagabond. The captain's wardroom aboard the Glorious had not been built to accommodate as many bodies as were crowded into it for Pakpakot's briefing. Lando suffered silently through 6 tedious reports on technical data before Pakpakot called for the one which most concerned him.
Foray, Commander, your report on team readiness to enter the vagabond.
Bijo Hammocks, technically astute and mentally tough, was one of the few officers under Pakpakot's command for whom Lando still had any respect after a month's exposure. Bijo stood.
The team is as ready as can be. We've identified 2 suspected hatchways and a couple of candidate sites in case we have to cut our way in.
Can I assume you'd have no problem being ready for a go order at 1500 hours tomorrow?
None at all, Colonel.
Thank you.
Pakpakot turned toward the other end of the room.
General Calrissian, what can you tell us about the vagabond's hailing signal?
Well, I can tell you that it's a dual-frequency carrier modulating up to 1,000 times a second. I can tell you that the data capacity is at least 50,000 units. And I can tell you that we still don't know if they're saying halt, or I'll shoot, or welcome to the Cold Space Bazaar, transmit credit information immediately. 3PO knows 6 million forms of communication, and he can't identify it. Have your people had any better luck?
Pakpakot looked down the table for an answer, and a young rating spoke up.
The contact protocol team believes that the signal recorded today is an automated collision alarm. In our opinion, it has no informational content.
Lando leaned forward.
Are you saying that the vagabond jumped to avoid a collision that was never going to happen?
You have another explanation, General?
Pakpakot asked.
How about that it was trying to get away from us?
Why would it wait until now to get away?
I'll give you 3 answers for the price of 1. Because some animals freeze first when a predator's nearby. Because until now we haven't made any aggressive moves. And because we flunked whatever intelligence test it sent us today.
General Calrissian, do you have any clear evidence of informational content in the signal?
No.
Thank you. Captain Hammocks, inform your team that we will begin operations at 1500 hours tomorrow.
All right, said Lando to his team. Tomorrow at 1500 hours, Colonel Pakpakot's going to send his brush salesman knocking at the vagabond's door. We're running out of time to offer the Colonel any alternatives. Let's do some serious brainstorming.
Hours later, Lando sighed impatiently.
Think, everyone, think. You want to lock up a spaceship you're sending out to the great nowhere. You want to make sure no outsider can get in uninvited, but you and yours always have access. You don't want to use a physical key because you don't want to let anyone that close without checking them out. So, we're talking about a password, basically. A really long binary passcode.
Forgive me, Master Lando, but in my experience, no sentient being could remember a password of this length and complexity, said 3PO.
Well, the answer might not be as long as the question, Lando began.
It could be longer, said Lobot.
That's not the point. Maybe the question only looks long and complex because we don't understand it. Human beings can remember incredibly long sequences if they have meaning,
I knew a smuggler who'd memorized the 100 prescriptions of Velcitus when he was a kid taking religious training, and he could still rattle them off 30 years later. And they're a species with much better memories than human beings.
I don't dispute that, said Lovat. Even so, passwords and access codes, whether mathematical or linguistic, are not error-tolerant. No matter how long the expected response may be, it must contain no errors.
Well, that's always the problem, isn't it? How do people remember all the things they have to remember? What do they do when there's something they can't allow themselves to forget? They cheat.
Mnemonics.
Yes, but they cheat in other ways, too. They carry the passcodes with them.
Lando started to pace.
Come on. We're getting close to something here. Where's the missing piece?
What about the fact that there are pairs of tones in the transmission? Asked Lobot.
Lando rubbed his hands together. Good, but are they pairs, or is it two separate channels of information? Think, Lobot, think.
Lobot could not have explained how he listened to the stream of data that passed through his consciousness in the next few seconds. In the early days of his training, he had imagined himself creating a sieve to place in the torrent, which would catch only the information he sought. But all metaphors ultimately failed. All he could say now was that he sent out his thoughts and brought back an answer. Long, non-random sequences are found in most genetic codes. The code for a single molecule would meet these conditions.
How many pairs are there in the fragment?
18.
How many species have 18 different molecular pairs in their genetic code?
Lobot lowered his eyes for a moment, searching for the answer. There are 6 recorded species with 18 pair genetic structures.
Do any of the 6 have a pitch-based language?
1. The Kella. I am passing the genetic sample library marker to R2-D2 for analysis. After several seconds, the droid had an answer.
What? Demanded Lando. What is it?
R2 says that there is a 99.9% certainty that the signal from the ship is a representation of a segment of the genetic code of the Kella. But the sequence ends in the middle. It's not complete.
Of course not, said Lando. That's the answer they're expecting. The rest of the sequence. R2, can you sing the next fragment?
Master Lando, an R2 unit has only a simple vocabulator, said 3PO. But if I may offer my assistance...
Give it a try.
For several seconds, 3PO and R2 huddled together over the droid transmission channel, passing information in binary. Then 3PO straightened up, looked toward Lando, and cocked his head.
The droid's rendition of the vagabond's hailing signal was distinctively different, but unmistakably the work of the same composer. All right. Lando punched the air with a fist. That's the key. We're going in the front door. 3PO, Lobot, tell me all about the Kella.
I have been accessing all records available to me, said Lobot. It seems that the Kella have been extinct for more than 150 years.
A few minutes before 1300 hours, Lando and Lobot slid into the cockpit of Lady Luck.
I figure we have 12 seconds minimum before they try to get a lock on us, said Lando. I intend to be inside no man's land by then. The moment Lady Luck disengaged from the docking ring, alarms began to sound on the bridge of Glorious. Lando heard the voice of Pak Pakot.
What do you think you're doing out there?
Research. I'd make sure I was recording this if I were you.
Turn your ship about, General. This is your last warning.
At that moment, the bridge was filled with the sounds of the vagabond's keening chorus.
Get a tractor beam on that ship, and I mean now.
Lando's face was tight with anxiety. Ready now, 3PO? Use every band you have.
Lando held his breath and waited.
Lobot glanced sideways at the display.
There's a secondary shield up. The Glorious's tractor beam has been deflected. We have been recognized. We have left the Colonel's armada and joined the Kella.
In the early morning of the Fifth Fleet's departure from Coruscant, a dark blue bubble-top fleet speeder reached the entry gate at Admiral Ackbar's residence on Victory Lake. It slowed only briefly, then was waved through. Admiral Ackbar himself met the visitor at the door.
Ah, Ichan, come in. Thank you for coming. There is someone I want you to meet.
Ackbar led the way into a round-walled inner room.
Hiram, this is Ichan Abbat. Ichan, Hiram Drayson is the director of Alpha Blue. Have you heard that name before?
No.
Good. You should not have until now. Hiram and Alpha have a charter that recognizes the ambiguities of war and politics and inherit the jobs which require working outside the rules of polite society.
Diplomatically put, said Drayson, smiling pleasantly.
Hiram has some information for you, Ethan. I would listen to him carefully. And now I will say good night.
Wait, where are you going?
Asked Abbat.
This conversation is not meant for my ears. I am going to the water column to sleep.
Drayson began without formalities. I've been trying for months to establish some assets in the Kurnak cluster. It hasn't been easy. Apparently, the Yavetha have a straightforward method of dealing with trespassers. They execute them on sight.
They like their privacy.
Perhaps a little too much, which is consistent with the behavior of the Viceroy here. The Yavetha stay in their ship, and the Viceroy limits his outside contacts to a few hours every other day with Leia. I don't know if there are 10 of them in there or 1,000.
You don't trust them either?
No, I don't. I'm certain that Nil Spar has been lying to Leia.
Is that why you're having this conversation with me instead of with the Princess?
That's one reason. The other is that you're going out there with 30 warships and she's not. Grayson rubbed his eyes. And here's something I keep thinking about. The Yavetha had just achieved interplanetary spaceflight at the time of the general survey. The species is very bright, technically clever, rather proud of themselves, but no threat to anyone.
Then the Empire shows up.
And puts the Yavetha to work in Imperial shipyards, building and repairing vessels which represent a big leap beyond what the Yavetha had been doing on their own. Whether or not the Yavetha acquired any ships or shipyards from the Empire, they almost certainly acquired the knowledge of how to build them.
They could have created their own Black Fleet.
Indeed. Let me ask you a question, General. Do you trust Leia's judgment where the Viceroy and the Yavetha are concerned?
Abbat looked away.
That's why you and I are having this meeting. I want you to come back without ever having had to open your gun ports. But if you do have to open them, I want you to know who you're trying to kill and why.
Is that all? I have people waiting for me.
No. There's one more thing. I understand you know Kyles LaToth, the associate director of the Astrographic Survey Institute.
We served together in the Dornian Navy.
More than that, you were friends. Perhaps he even owes you a favor.
You know too much. What are you getting at?
The Institute is a long way from the fleet office or the palace. It must be nice not to have everyone breathing down your neck. And they've been given everything they need, a whole fleet of astrographic and survey vessels.
Abbat stared, struck silent.
Maybe you should call him before you leave, Drayson suggested softly. Standing inside the hatch of the four-seat shuttle he had flown up to the Glorious, General Han Solo tugged unhappily at the stiff fabric of his uniform, trying to make it more comfortable. The flight deck crew already had an egress ladder in place for him, and the deck officer was waiting at the bottom of it.
Lieutenant, Han said. Permission to come aboard.
General Solo, sir.
Granted. Welcome aboard. I hadn't heard that you were coming to see us off, sir.
I'm not. Han descended the ladder. I'm coming along for the ride. Have my gear brought off the shuttle, and then get one of your ferry pilots to take this thing back to the station, will you?
Yes, sir, right away.
The lieutenant looked at Han with the slightly worshipful eagerness he had learned to expect, but never to accept.
I'm just sorry you didn't come up in the Falcon, sir. I would have liked to see her.
I'd kind of like to see her right now myself. Where is General Abbott?
The General's not aboard, sir. We're expecting him at any time. I could show you to the bridge.
Han tugged at the tight collar of his shirt.
If you could just find out where my quarters are, that would do for now. Oh, and let me know when General Abbott comes aboard.
Han was asleep in his quarters on board the Glorious when he was startled awake by a sharp noise. Sitting bolt upright, he found a tall Dornian in a fleet command uniform looming over him. The age lines on the Dornian's face showed him to be over 100 years old. The bars on his jacket showed that he was General Abbott.
General Solo,
Abbott said.
There's a rumor all over the ship that I'm out and you're in. Want to tell me what that's about?
Han swung his feet over the side of the bunk.
I don't know what that's about. You're the commander of the Fifth Fleet. Nothing's changed.
Why are you here, if not to replace me?
I thought you could figure that one out on your own.
I do not enjoy the princess's full confidence.
Right. But I do. So if I tell her everything's fine, she'll believe it.
If you're not here to replace me, are you here to find her a reason to do so?
I'm here to help you not do anything stupid. If it turns out you don't need any help with that, that's fine with me. I'll sharpen up my Barlaz game in your rec hall, find out where your quartermaster keeps the medicinal dragon juice, and catch up on my sleep. I'm not here to make your job harder.
By the time Colonel Pac-Picot reached a comm station, the Lady Luck had moved to within 2 kilometers of the Vagabond and was closing at a rate that would place it alongside in a matter of minutes. The sight of it brought the threat ruffles on Pac-Picot's back to full flourish, and his throat turned crimson, a display no one in his bridge crew had ever seen before.
Calrissian, you're a madman. You will lose more than your commission over this, I promise you that.
Colonel, I'll take that as your promise to do everything you can to help keep me alive long enough to satisfy your fine sense of outrage.
Pac-Picot fumed.
You obviously came here with secret information about this vessel, which you denied to us.
Secret information? What are you blathering about, Colonel?
You as much as admitted it. You knew that the target was expecting her countersign, which you already possessed.
Colonel, we didn't have any secret information. We simply happened to look in the right place in the Imperial Archives, and just barely in time, too. Now we're in, and we're going to do what we can while we're here.
Since making its pass at the Vagabond the day before, D-89 had been flying formation with the Glorious, awaiting its next job as the second spotter platform for the long-range stereo recordings to be made of the 4A team's contact. When its real space engine suddenly roared to life, it had only a few kilometers to cover before reaching the invisible boundary of the Vagabond's security sphere. D-89 was still accelerating when the Vagabond hailed it. A signal heard on board the Lady Luck and the Glorious as well. Lobot was the first to realize the cause.
There's another vessel approaching the Vagabond.
Almost at the same time, 3PO said,
Master Lando, that's not the same sequence.
I know, I can hear it. I was afraid he was going to try this.
The signal from the Vagabond ended, and the response began, relayed from the Glorious through D-89's own transmitters. But even before the response was complete, a fierce blue light began dancing over the entire aft third of the Vagabond's hull.
Hold on, everyone!
Lando threw himself across the console, reaching for the control that would boost the Lady Luck's combat shields with the full output of her engines.
But his hand had not reached the switch before the cockpit was flooded with a light so harsh that even 3PO flinched from it. One by one, Lando silenced the alarms. The ship seemed unharmed, even untouched.
What was that?
I'm showing an explosion 8 kilometers aft of us, said Lobot. It was the Ferret D-89. No one was on board.
With a touch on the console, Lando signaled the cruiser.
Colonel, one of these days, you're going to learn to stop ignoring what I tell you.
Anytime you care to start telling me the truth, General, I will be happy to listen. The Vagabond allowed you to approach, and now it's protecting you.
General, the challenge to the Ferret was different from the challenge to us. Probably to stop someone from doing exactly what you tried to do, namely snoop and steal the key. If the Vagabond's protecting us, it's only because it thinks we belong here.
R2 and 3PO had been having their own conversation at the rear of the yacht's flight deck, and now 3PO stepped forward to where Lando and Lobot sat.
Sir?
Wait, 3PO.
Sir, R2 says that the new sequence sent by the Keller vessel does not appear in the information from the survey archives.
What?
R2 says he is unable to determine what the correct response might be.
Lando shook his head.
I feel like I'm in a spelling bee, and the kid in front of me just went out on a word I don't know either.
Colonel, are you getting all this?
Getting it? Yes. Understanding it? No.
We matched the original signal from the Vagabond to the genetic code of a species called the Kella. The correct response was the next portion of the code, but it interrogated the Ferret with a different sequence, and we don't know what comes next.
With the Lady Luck cruising slowly along the hull of the Vagabond at a distance of only 100 meters, Lando saw the ship clearly for the first time. At a distance, the hull seemed lumpy and irregular. Up close, it looked like nothing so much as a massive tree trunk with thick crisscrossing vines which had grown into the metallic bark. But the vines were large enough to park the yacht in, and the trunk would easily have swallowed the cruiser.
Maybe those extrusions are some sort of energy conduit for the weapons, said Lando. I can't see anything else that looks like a weapon.
Lando, said Lobot suddenly, look. The surface of the Vagabond had suddenly come alive with small pale patches of light. They appeared and disappeared in orderly patterns along the top of the hull extrusions, forming sequences that drew the eye forward, then to the edge of the curving hull where they disappeared.
Oh no, R2, look out, it's getting ready to fire again, 3PO exclaimed.
There is another possibility, said Lobot. This could be the next question for us.
Hakpakat's voice came forcefully over the comlink.
General, I strongly suggest you drop the limpet and get your people out of there.
No. I want to know what's happening on the rest of the hull, the part we can't see. Where do the lights go, Lobot?
I am monitoring.
3PO, can you make anything out of this?
I do not recognize this as any form of language known to me, Master Lando, but perhaps it is not linguistic, but symbolic communication.
What are you talking about?
Sir, perhaps they are pointers. Might I suggest that you follow them backwards to the point of divergence?
Lando reached for the thruster controls. At the spot from which the light seemed to appear, a dark hole irised open, and the lights vanished.
They're inviting us inside, said Lobot.
Well, I'll be the last pup of an ion storm, Lando breathed.
So they are, Lobot.
So they are. Let's suit up.
The yacht's outer airlock and the opening in the Vagabond's hull were mismatched in both shape and size. The solution was an old invention which Lando had made standard equipment on all his vessels, an extensible cofferdam. Flexible yet vapor-tight, the enclosure could telescope out from the hull of Lady Luck and attach itself to the other ship, forming a tunnel between the airlocks. Lando locked the helmet of his suit in place with a twist as the cofferdam extended and pressurized.
Looks like a good seal, he said. Pressure is holding.
Kakpakot, reduced now to the role of spectator, sent a last message.
Good luck, General. I envy you.
The cofferdam had rigid rings with handholds spaced at intervals, which Lando used to propel himself through the 5-meter-long tunnel between the ships. He paused outside the vagabond's portal to switch on his suit and helmet lights. The lights revealed little detail inside the Keller vessel, only an empty space enclosed by blank walls of the same mottled color as the hull itself. Grasping the upper rim of the opening, Lando floated himself through, twisting to look in all directions.
All right, I'm in. This chamber is about twice my height in every dimension. Plenty of room for all four of us. No response to my presence yet. There's no light, and there doesn't seem to be another doorway.
He paused for a moment.
Wait. That's odd. I don't know why or how, but I can see the attachment ring through the bulkhead. There's a shadow, exactly that size, visible on the inside.
Lobot checked his display.
Not visible on the relay. Are you saying that the hull is translucent, Lando?
Well, yes.
Lando brushed his gloved fingertips across the surface. He could feel that the shadow was slightly raised.
R2, Lobot, 3PO, why don't you come on over and see what you can make of this? Maybe there's something about the mottling on the walls, Lando said, as R2 investigated the spot on the wall and Lobot hovered beside him.
Maybe if we touch the right pattern of spots. Have you ever seen Donati's stain painting?
No, I haven't. What's that got to do with anything?
To human perception, stain painting consists of huge canvases covered with random splotches of color. The Donati sit and stare at a painting for 10 minutes or more at a time. They begin to meditate and end up in a state of high rapture. R2 is the only one of us capable of seeing the entire chamber at once. He can reprocess the image according to the parameters I provide and project it for us to see.
It is said on Gaios that a seed does not know the flower that produced it. What is true of seeds and flowers is true of civilizations and worlds. In the long history of the galaxy, many a family tree has grown too tangled to be clearly remembered by either ancestor or descendant. The people who called themselves the Kella had no children of their own. They did, however, have parents, parents they scarcely remembered, but to whom much of what they were and knew could be traced. The parents of the Kella had called themselves the Kone, and they had had many offspring, as had their parents, who called themselves the Arunafi. So, although the Kella had no children, they had siblings in some number, and cousins close and distant in numbers beyond counting. It was with the hope of finding such kin as the Kella might have that Lobot sifted the archives of the Institute for Sentient Studies. He knew no more about the family history of the Kella than did the Kella themselves, but he knew the patterns and principles that applied. His hope depended not on luck, but on a well-chosen search algorithm, the thoroughness of the archivists, and the fruitfulness and resilience of the Arunafi line. Or at least so Lobot would forever claim. Luck was Lando's game, and Lobot preferred to distance himself from anything so ephemeral and unpredictable. It was a silent rivalry, and Lobot took unvoiced pleasure from the times when Lando's way failed him, and Lobot's own way succeeded. He prided himself on playing a more precise and controlled line, where competence counted for more than chance, and diligence was rewarded more often than daring. This time, the reward was the mind prints of a man named Konai. The image R2 was projecting covered only part of one wall, but incorporated the patterns of the entire chamber as they would have been perceived by a Kella.
There, said Lando, in that corner. There's your big red switch.
Pushing off from the equipment sled 3PO had brought, he floated toward the corner. But although Lando pushed on the handle several times, it would not budge. Then R2 tried, also to no avail. Realizing the handle might be temperature sensitive, Lando tugged the glove off his right hand and reached out to touch the freezing cold bulkhead. It retreated under his touch, the surface folding back on all sides until there was a hole deep enough that Lando was uncertain whether he could reach the farthest recesses.
He did it!
3PO exulted. Lando peered into the opening.
There's some sort of handle back here.
Drawing a deep breath, he reached in with his bare hand. There was a flash of brilliant blue light outside the portal, and when it was gone, so was the tunnel to Lady Luck's airlock. In the next instant, the atmosphere in the chamber began boiling out into space, sweeping everything and everyone toward the open portal. Lando clung desperately to the handle, though he lost his grip on the glove and watched it being whisked away beyond his reach. But R2, Lobot, and 3PO spun crazily toward the opening. The glove, far lighter and moving faster than any of the party, struck the outer bulkhead and tumbled out into space. But bare moments before R2 reached the opening, there was suddenly no opening. As neatly as the portal had opened under Lando's touch, it knitted itself closed.
The ship's moving! Lando cried, feeling the acceleration pressing him more firmly against the aft bulkhead. Hammocks! Colonel! What's going on?
There was no answer, not even static.
Anyone on the Glorious, respond!
Lando, all my links are gone. We're not just moving. This ship just jumped into hyperspace.
Long before they reached Lukaszek, Luke Skywalker settled on Mudsloth as the name for Akana's previously unnamed Verpine adventurer, because the craft was so slow. At Akana's suggestion, they adopted a watch schedule which had them sleeping at opposite ends of the day so that each would have more privacy. Akana read from a battered old datapad, meditated in the co-pilot's couch, and intently studied the adventurer's owner, pilot, and system programs. They did take meals together, dipping twice a day into her modest cache of stabilized food stores, many of them long-expired Imperial Expedition packs, a telltale sign of desperately tight finances. During a meal they shared near the end of the journey, Luke tore open a pouch of Noryoth Brown meat bread.
16 more hours. I hate the waiting.
Do you think there's any chance the Felonasi may have come back after the war?
No,
said Akana. You see, the Empire feared as well as coveted our power. They didn't come down with weapons drawn to round us up as they did with so many other populations they enslaved. We were divided among ourselves about the coming war and what our moral duty was. The Imperial Governor General Tag came to Wialu, the woman who held the Wand of Privilege. He said it was important for us to show our loyalty to the Empire, that that was the only way we could escape the fate of the Jedi. We knew they were being hunted down as traitors and sorcerers. Wialu refused General Tagger. She told him that the loyalty of the Felonasi was to the light.
Tagger, I remember now, said Luke. He was on the first Death Star when Leia was a prisoner.
He paused.
He was probably still on board when my proton torpedo blew it to bits. Luke didn't know what possessed him to make that claim before Akana, and her response made him feel even more foolish for having done so. She stiffened as he spoke, and he could feel her withdraw from him.
Do you seek honor from me for this? In time, you will understand that the Felonasi honor no heroes for killing, not even killing one who has been our tormentor, said Akana.
I'm sorry. Luke wondered at his own words. Everything suddenly seemed upside down. It was strange and unsettling that the deed for which he had been so lionized, killing an enemy who had been his own sister's tormentor, had now become touched with regret. That moment had decided both his future and the galaxy's, and he had never in all the years since questioned the rightness of what he had done. Akana nodded, and her face seemed to soften.
I will not speak of it again.
Luke was happy to leave behind his unthinking words and the jumbled thoughts and alarming feelings that had followed them. How did the Empire respond to Wialu? Is that when you left Lukasik?
No, not until later, said Akana. Taga then tried to force us to come to him by destroying our relationship with our neighbors. We shopped in villages near ours and hired workers from them. Taga placed agents in those villages to kill house animals, set fires, turn the waters bitter, and make other strange things happen.
And then blame the Falanasi, Luke guessed.
Yes. That was when my mother sent me away. Not to protect me, because she and the others could protect the children well enough, but she didn't want to expose me to the hate that surrounded us.
They were to send for us when Lukasik was peaceful again, or come for us when they headed for a new home. But they never did.
No. I never heard from any of the body again.
The region of Lukasik that Akana called the North Plateau had no true spaceport. Luke was directed to set the mud sloth down at a quiet little airfield, identified only by its latitude and longitude. There he and Akana were met by three men wearing drab brown clothing, who identified themselves as the airfield marshal, the district censor, and the port magistrate. The censor had a small recorder.
Point of origin?
Coruscant, said Luke.
Purpose of your visit?
Research, said Akana. Archaeological research.
No digging is permitted without a license from the Proctor of History,
the magistrate warned them.
All artifacts must be submitted to the office of the Proctor.
Of course, Luke said. His gaze settled on the censor. Was there anything else?
The man puffed up his chest.
I must see your identity cards, of course.
Luke intensified his focus on the man.
We've already shown them to you.
The censor's eyes were suddenly blank.
Of course. You'll want to hire a cart. Go by the East District Trail. The bridge at Crown Pass Road has been out since the last rain.
They jolted along over the rutted road in one of the big-wheeled, two-seated utility vehicles common on Lukasik, passing no other vehicle or person along the way. In its heyday, Yaltra, the village of the Falanasi, had had more than 30 buildings. The circle house had stood three stories high with a great open archway and tiled facings in complex abstract designs. Its rooftop gardens, fed by pipe and solar pump, offered not only lush grass and flowers, but a view over the surrounding hills. Medicinal and food crops once grew under three translucent domes nestled between pairs of small workhouses. Ring dwellings had been scattered everywhere, each with half a dozen sleeping cottages surrounding the common rooms. Yaltra had enjoyed two wells and a walled pond, and a long, wandering meditation trail with more than a dozen hillside shelters. None of it remained untouched. The circle house had collapsed into rubble. The growing domes had been exploded from within. Fragments of the clear crystalline material littered the ground everywhere, crunching under Luke and Akana's feet. The walled pond had been breached and was bone dry. The well had been filled with masonry. Akana stood by one dwelling, biting her lower lip. Anguish radiated from her with such intensity that Luke found it necessary to shield himself.
This was our home, she said at last.
Luke waited outside, granting Akana privacy in the ruins of her memories. She rejoined him a few minutes later, standing taller and seeming stronger.
They weren't here when this happened, she said. Whether they were taken or escaped, none of them died here.
Why do you say that? Luke asked.
Because of the way it feels here. I don't know quite how to describe it, except that I'm sure that I'd be able to feel it if even one of us had been killed here. This was an empty gesture.
It feels that way to me, too. And I'd vote for escaped. I think they desecrated your home because that was all they could do. He paused.
Akana? Which was my mother's house?
Akana closed her eyes in thought for a moment, then pointed across the compound.
Number 4. Go on. I'm all right.
Nodding his appreciation, Luke turned and started toward the ruined ring dwelling at the foot of the highest of the enclosing hills. But he was not even halfway there when a scream froze him. He whirled, his cape sweeping outward, and a blaster bolt burned past him, so close that he could smell the heat. He rolled away from it, came out of the roll with a forward flip that carried him 5 meters away from where he had stood, and ended the flip searching for his attacker, lightsaber in his hand. There were two men near Akana, who was huddled on her knees with an arm raised as though she had just fended off a blow. Akana! Luke charged toward them. The next blaster bolt was dead on target. But Luke deflected it neatly skyward with his lightsaber. He drew deeply on the force and reached out to crush the blaster with a thought as powerful as a vice. His next thought yanked the disabled weapon from the man's hand and hurled it out of reach. Seeing what he was doing, Akana shouted, "No, Luke, don't!" But Luke's focus was on the second man, who was also pointing a weapon at Akana. "Keep your distance!" the man shouted at Luke. Luke's answer was a thought blow that tore the blaster from the man's hand and smashed it against the wall of the dwelling behind him. It shattered into a dozen fragments. Then he was on them, the lightsaber held for attack, not defense. The first man he had disarmed projected a personal shield which blunted Luke's initial stroke. The blow took the man to his knees all the same. The next stroke sliced through the shield and deep into the assailant's chest. He gasped, then crumpled onto the ground. Turning quickly, Luke found the second man reaching for Akana, as though meaning to use her as his shield. Luke threw his lightsaber, spinning the weapon end for end with a sharp snap of his wrist. It scythed through the air, severing the attacker's left arm above the elbow. The man screamed and collapsed as Luke brought the lightsaber back to his hand. "Who are you?" Luke demanded, standing over the fallen attacker.
"Commander Paffin reporting. Skywalker..."
With a flick of his lightsaber, Luke disabled the comm unit on the man's equipment belt.
"Who are you? Why are you here?"
"Not fair. Waited so long. We only expected the witch."
"Why were you waiting? What did you want?"
"They said the poison wouldn't hurt."
Then the man died, still staring at the sky. Luke crouched beside Akana, who was still huddled on the ground, shaking from head to toe and sobbing.
"Akana, are you hurt?"
She recoiled violently from his touch.
"I wasn't in danger. There was no reason for what you did."
"What I did? I thought you were in trouble."
"Couldn't you have protected us without harming them?"
Luke extended his awareness, searching the ruins, the hills. "We'll have to talk about this later. Those were Imperial agents. There's no telling how close their friends are. We have to leave."
"But would the Empire risk sending a ship this deep into New Republic territory?"
"That depends on how badly someone still wants the Falanasi," Luke said. "I don't think we should wait around to see." Akana calmed herself and rose.
"Very well. On the wall of the house I saw a symbol that my mother left for me. It tells where we must go next. But here's one more thing. You need to go inside your mother's cottage."
He shook his head sadly. "There isn't time."
"Take the time."
Luke sat in the middle of the ruined cottage and whispered his mother's name as if to ask the broken stones if they remembered it.
"Ashira."
But the sound fled into the dark corners and vanished. He brushed the litter aside and pressed the palms of his hands to the floor, drew the dusty air deep into his nostrils, and tasted it on his tongue.
"Mother."
The reality of the moment welled up inside him. It was a point of contact after so many years without one. She had been where he was now. It did not matter that he could not find her touch lingering on the rude substance surrounding him. The knowledge alone was enough. Near a brown dwarf star on the edge of the Kurnat cluster, the New Republic astrographic probe Astrolabe dropped out of hyperspace. The broad, flat underside of the small, unarmed ship was heavily studded with scanners. 4 scan platforms carried everything from stereo imagers and neutron dippers to quark detectors and wideband photometricons. The combination of the thin, wide profile and the scanner configuration had given the Astrogator-class probes the nickname of Flatfish.
Your tour operators, the Astrographic Survey Institute, welcome you to Dornick 1142, the pilot called back to his survey team. Make sure you take time to look out the viewports.
It was an old joke and drew no more than ritual chuckles from the survey team. ASI vessels were the restless, peripatetic travelers of the stars. The crew's job was to map and survey a star system, not to tour any place personally. The pilot, an 18-year veteran known as Gabby, had overflown more than 1,000 planets in his career, but had only set foot on 3. This mission began like all the others. Then, without warning, the ship began to shake violently.
Something's wrong with the engines, one of the crew members shouted.
In the next moment, the air was ripped from his lungs in a frosty plume, and silence reigned. Vol Noor, Yavathan primate of the battlecruiser Purity, watched approvingly as a fierce salvo of high-energy laser pulses blindsided the intruding vessel.
Send out the salvos. Make certain they maintain hygienic protocols on all material recovered.
Then Vol Noor locked himself in the communications booth to transmit what would be the only alert concerning the destruction of the Astrolabe. A short burst of code aimed at the Viceroy's flagship Aramedia, ground moored at Imperial City's Eastport.
Three days in a row now, Princess Leia said to those gathered in the staff conference room. Does anyone have any hint why Nilspar has been canceling our sessions?
Intelligence Director General Carlos Rican turned to her.
I have some information given to me just before I left the office to come over here. The Viceroy received visitors today on board the Aramedia.
What? Exclaimed First Administrator Nanayod Ing. They haven't allowed anyone but their own past the portal since they arrived. Who was it?
Senator Paramus, Senator Hodigiti, and Senator Marouk. They arrived together and stayed more than 2 hours.
Admiral Akbar stood up.
Let's get them in here and we'll get some answers.
Easy, my friend, Leia cautioned. The Viceroy has every right to meet with whomever he chooses. He doesn't need our permission to hold a tea party.
Princess, Rican said, forgive me. If you were not ready to hear the answers, why did you ask the question?
Leia turned to him and frowned. What are you talking about?
You asked if anyone had any notion why the Viceroy was canceling his sessions with you. Now you learn that he's met privately with some of the Senate's most iconoclastic members. He's not only broken all precedent, but pointedly extended courtesies to others that he's never extended to you. And you refuse to draw the obvious conclusion.
Which is?
That your negotiations with Nilspar are over.
I can't believe he would throw all our work away without so much as a word.
The room was flooded with light. Out the transparasteel, they could see the spherical shape of Aramedia slowly ascending from the spaceport, with its 3 tiny escorts circling it like planets around a star.
I guess we'll have to believe it now, said Eng.
Aramedia went into orbit 40 clicks below the lower limit of Coruscant's planetary shield. There it remained for the next 2 hours, as mute and inscrutable as ever. At the rostrum of the Senate chamber, Chairman Ben Kilnum gaveled the body into order. Senator Paramus rose and was recognized.
Most of you know by now that the Yavathan consular ship Aramedia made an unscheduled liftoff from Eastport this morning. I have been informed that 3 port employees are dead and more than a score injured.
Ben Kilnum reached out and dragged an aide closer by means of a fistful of fabric.
Call the princess. Tell her she'd better get herself down here now and bring her fire suit.
Senator Paramus continued.
So far, there's been no information forthcoming from the president's office about these events. The princess has been unavailable, and there's been only silence from her staff.
Senator Tolik Yar shot to his feet.
A point of privilege is not a license to slander and defame, sir.
Perrineau shot Tulloch a look of contempt.
Sit down and listen, Senator. Chairman, I ask that the Senate recorder activate the chamber's display screens and set them to channel 81, the diplomatic frequency.
For what purpose, Senator?
For the purpose of allowing Viceroy Nil Spar of the Avatha to address this body from aboard Aramedia, which is presently orbiting Coruscant.
Then Kilnam pounded his gavel.
Senator Perimus, this is most irregular. Do you accept responsibility for your speaker's remarks as though they were your own, including any and all sanctions that would fall on any member of this body for transgressions against the Senate's code of conduct? I do. Then proceed with your presentation.
When Ben Kilnam's warning reached Princess Leia in her office, she was headed not for the door, but for the darkened display on which she was able to monitor the Senate's hypercom feed on Channel 11. I'm not rushing down there to put out a fire until I know what's burning, she told Akbar, who sat with her. Moments later, they were joined by First Administrator Eng, who had been routinely monitoring the Senate on his own, and came running, outraged, to alert Leia.
Did you hear, Perimus? No information forthcoming.
Oh, bless Tulloch Yar, anyway. Perimus hasn't even called here. He didn't try to get our side of it.
Shh, Leia said.
I can't hear what he's saying.
They did not have to watch long before Leia concluded there was little she could accomplish by going to the chamber.
They know me, she said. They know Senator Perimus. Let him make whatever intimations he wants. The Senate won't rush to judgment. I'll get my turn to be heard. But not today, in a shouting match.
His long fingers steepled, Hiram Drayson leaned back in his chair and watched as the face of Nil Spar appeared on the Senate monitor.
Before I begin, I want to share my deep regrets over the unfortunate casualties resulting from our ascent from Eastport. It was with great sorrow that I learned our warnings had not been honored, and the thrust radius of the Aramedia had not been cleared. We had no intention of injuring anyone. We left Eastport to avoid a confrontation, not to cause one.
Ah, very good, Drayson said to himself. Well done.
I regret the casualties, but I cannot take responsibility for them. For more than 3 days, we requested clearance to leave Coruscant. 3 members of your Senate witnessed 2 such attempts and can testify that we received only silence in reply.
Stars on fire, First Administrator Eng breathed as everyone in Leia's quarters watched the proceedings. Is it possible that any of this is true? Could there have been some sort of misunderstanding and we didn't hear them asking for clearance?
Shut up. Leia said. It became clear that the government of Leia Organa intended to hold us here against our will. We could not wait any longer. I would have trouble believing this if there were not other evidence of her bad faith.
The screen flickered, and Nil Spar's face was replaced by images of burned and twisted metal laid out on bronze decking.
What you see now is the wreckage of a New Republic spy ship which violated the territorial hegemony of the Duskan League 4 days ago. It self-destructed when spotted by a local patrol vessel, but we were able to recover enough of it to identify its purpose and origin.
At that moment, Leia and her advisors, the audience in the Senate, in offices all over Imperial City and on worlds throughout the New Republic, saw Yavathan hands turn over a large fragment to reveal a recognizable portion of the New Republic seal, the blue crest, the ring of stars, and the gold circle. Drayson leaned forward, staring, then slowly rose to his feet.
Bloody bilge. That's no prowler. That's a flatfish, or used to be.
He stabbed at his datapad with a finger. Verify.
Verify, Drayson, Hiram.
Call Kyles Latoth. Scramble.
Calling Kyles Latoth. Waiting. Verifying. Ready.
Kyles, this is Drayson. Is that one of your ships being splashed all over the grids by the Yavathan ambassador?
The associate director's voice was shaky.
Yes, we think so. It could be the astrolabe. She's 4 hours overdue from her logout from Dornick 1142.
4 hours? The Viceroy said this happened 4 days ago. How is it you didn't know you'd lost a bird?
Admiral, you know there's not usually much traffic while they're in system. Look, what he's saying, it's not true. Astrolabe wasn't on a spy mission. This was routine survey work.
I didn't ask, but others will. Better work on your answers. Princess Leia's face went white when 3 oblong red body bags appeared on the monitor.
I regret to report that there were no survivors. We were able to recover 3 bodies, which we are prepared to make arrangements to return. But we cannot and will not negotiate this or any other matter with President Princess Leia Organa Solo. Everything she has said to us has been revealed by her actions as a lie. At this very moment, I, my staff, and my crew are imprisoned within the planetary shield of Coruscant.
Leia shook her head in disbelief. He's misinterpreted everything. How could this have happened?
Leia, we must do something,
Aang pleaded. She nodded, and it seemed a great effort. Contact General Baintoff. Have him open the shield. Tell the Aramadia to go. Ask Ben-Kilnam to appoint a representative of the Senate to arrange retrieval of the bodies. Admiral Akbar? The Calamari, who had been staring out the transparisteel, turned back to find the princess standing near the door.
Yes, Leia.
Why was one of our ships anywhere near Cornacht? Did you know anything about this?
I do not have any answers,
Akbar said uncomfortably. Try to find some for me. And Leia turned away.
Where are you going?
Leia looked back over her shoulder. Home. To think about resigning. The Battle Operations Center of the fleet carrier Intrepid was deserted except for 2 generals carrying unhappy burdens. General Eitan Abbott carried the burden of knowing what he had done, while General Han Solo carried the burden of knowing what must come. For more than 2 hours, Abbott had been signaling Coruscant, attempting to speak directly with Princess Leia. Finally, the hypercom lit up and squawked a red line alert. When the holo display brightened to show Leia from the shoulders up, Han was startled by how pallid her face was, how dark and lifeless her eyes.
General Abbott, I understand from Admiral Akbar that you have some information for me.
Yes, Princess.
He sat tall in his chair.
I am the person responsible for the astrographic probes being sent into Farlax. Before the 5th sailed, I requested an updated survey of that sector, including Cornacht Cluster. I did this with the full knowledge that it was in violation of your orders.
There was hardly a flicker of reaction on Leia's face.
Thank you, General. You are relieved of command, effective immediately.
Her eyes sought Han.
General Solo.
Han stepped forward.
Yes, Leia.
I'm placing you in command in General Abbott's stead. Your orders are to bring the 5th Fleet back to Coruscant as soon as possible.
The holo display went dark. Abbott turned away from the hypercom and stood.
I'm sorry. You will need to recall the patrols before turning the formation.
Sure. Now forget the excuses and tell me why you did it.
When Abbott hesitated, Han said, That's an order.
Very well. I believed I had been denied the information I needed to do my job properly. Both parts of it, protecting my command and protecting the New Republic's interests. Princess Leia made a military decision for political reasons. And it left me in an untenable position. I attempted to make an end run around her objections by going outside of the fleet to the Astrographic Survey Institute. You already know the results.
I think I do. Do you?
What do you mean?
That flatfish was no spy ship.
No.
And it didn't blow itself up, did it?
No.
Then maybe it found what you were worried is out here.
Perhaps so. But it doesn't matter. The probe made no report, and there'll be no more probes sent into that area. Whatever secrets the Yveta have, they'll keep.
Well, we know someone out there is unfriendly to the New Republic, right?
I'd say so.
Seems as though we'd better do something to cover our withdrawal, then. Does that seem reasonable to you?
You are in command of the fleet, General Solo.
So I am. Now show me which one of these buttons calls in your tactical staff.
The transfer between Aramedia and the 8-kilometer-long Star Destroyer Pride of Yveta took place at a rendezvous point deep in the heart of the Kurnak Cluster, far from any prying eyes. Nil Spar and his staff were met by Dar Billet, who had been the Viceroy's loyal second since long before the Day of Retribution. Now Primate of Pride of Yveta, he had directed the training of the other primates as each former Imperial warship had joined the growing Black Fleet.
Nil Spar spoke to him warmly.
Dar, lead me to the bridge. Is the fleet ready?
The fleet is well ready.
As he followed Dar Billet into the corridor, Nil Spar let his fingertips graze the bare necks of the officers who knelt as he passed them. The touch symbolized his acceptance of the offer of their lives and freed them to rise.
As they reached the bridge, Dar Billet addressed the Proctor of Information.
Lefarth, what news do you have of the New Republic's Fifth Fleet?
Primate, our shadow reports the fleet has disappeared from Hatawa. Our contacts on Coruscant tell us that it has been recalled.
Nil Spar bowed his head and breathed relief.
I am vindicated. I wish to speak to all our vessels.
Turning quickly toward the Proctor of Communications, Dar Billet arranged the necessary connections and announced the Viceroy to the crews of the 25 warships secreted in twos and threes across the cluster.
Nil Spar began to speak.
Remember that we are the Blessed, born of the light of the All. All beauty belongs to us. It was not meant for the creatures that creep in from the darkness beyond. Today, we will remove them, as the steward of a granary must remove the vermin to keep the stocks pure. I direct you to commence your tasks. May each of us honor the name of the Yveta today.
Wearing an approving look on his dirty, deep-lined face, Negus Negakus slammed the check hatch shut and threw the locking bolt home. The ore sheds were more than two-thirds full, and there was still a month to go before the gypsy freighter returned to New Brigia. Perhaps this time there would be enough profit over the cost of their supplies to clear the last of their passage debt. Negagus would never have dreamed that after 15 years working the chromite digs, the little colony would still owe a debt to the captain of the freighter that had brought them here. He had no sooner started across the common toward the processing dome when tall creatures in green and brown body armor began advancing through the village in a wide line, their weapons turning cottages into burned and broken shells. A child's screaming pierced the din of the machinery, then ended with ominous abruptness. Negakus was ignored or overlooked long enough to take half a dozen uncertain steps out into the common, long enough to realize in horror that some of the blackened objects littering the ground were bodies. Then he found his voice and cried out his rage, raised both fists in defiance, and started across the common toward the nearest soldier. A silver-barreled weapon turned his way, and Negakus fell in agony, his last breath full of fire. In a garden city on Jetepatan, a world gentled by patient hands, a woman awoke from a dream to a nightmare. A falling star became a starship, the starship a warship, and the warship a fountain of death raining on the face of the world. The current ran wild with the thrashings of murdered souls, dark with the stain of blood. Wialu shook her daughter awake.
Rouse everyone at once. Hurry! Something terrible has begun.
Of the 13 alien settlements visited by the ships of the Black Fleet in the first hour of the Great Purge, Polnei was the largest and the only one to fight back.
Alarms began to sound the moment the Yavathan scout fighters cleared the ionization boundary above the planet's clouds, calling technicians to rarely tended stations. Many others ran outside and looked up at the sky. Those whose eyes were sharp enough saw three tiny black ships circling just below the clouds. One was over the city called 9 South, a second over 11 North, and the third over the ghost city of 14 North, which was being cannibalized for its structures and equipment. Then fire poured down from the sky. A young technical student named Plat Malar began running toward the airfield. By the time he settled in the cockpit of the TIE interceptor he had just started learning to fly and started the power-up sequence, two other would-be pilots had arrived. With a bump and a lurch, Malar's ship cleared the bay, bursting out into the bright, diffuse light of a Phonei midday. The tiny black ships were still circling high in the air, like carrion birds. Activating his targeting system, Malar was heartened to see that three more of the settlement's TIE interceptors were in the air. Selecting the nearest target and steering towards it, he squeezed both triggers of the quad cannon. No one was more surprised than Malar when the target stayed in his sights and then exploded in a yellow-white gout of flame. In the next moment, Malar was suddenly blinded by light pouring in through the viewports. The interceptor was shoved roughly sideways, as though by a great hand, and shuddered violently in the aftermath. For a long moment, he was certain his ship had been hit and he was about to die. But the moment stretched out, and he did not die. The after image of the flash began to fade from Malar's eyes, and his ship, still climbing, emerged intact. Immediately, the targeting system beeped urgently at him, and Malar squinted, first to read the display, then to peer out the viewport. What he saw nearly overwhelmed him with fear. Riding above him in orbit was the largest ship he had ever seen, a great triangular shape bristling with gun ports and launching fighters from bays on either side. Falling the interceptor over on its back, he dove away from the starship at all possible speed. The fight for Polnei did not last long. Plat Malar's success against the TIE was the only victory of the day, and no one was more aware than he how meaningless it was. Because he was afraid to die, he fled to the far side of the planet, hiding in the clouds under the ionization shield the Empire had long ago created. Calmly, ruthlessly, efficiently, the Black Fleet drew a curtain of death across the Kurnacht cluster. One after another, the vermin settlements fell beneath it. Full sterilizations were carried out on the two worlds to be reclaimed for the Yavetha. Colonists meant for those planets were already outbound in new thrust ships faster than light itself. Others would soon follow. It was the realization of a great destiny. At the end of one long day of glory, the All again belonged to the Yavetha alone. Leia Organa Solo waited eagerly behind the gate for the fleet shuttle to land at Eastport 18. The moment the engines were cut, she brushed past the gate supervisor and ran out onto the landing pad. When the hatch hissed open and the boarding stairs unfolded, she was waiting at the bottom. Han was the first to appear on the top step, wearing his lopsided grin and carrying his flight bag over one shoulder. Taking the stairs in three long strides, he tossed the flight bag down and gathered Leia up in a hug so deep and warm that it almost drove away the icy chill that had invaded her spirit since the collapse of the Yavathan negotiations and her humiliation by Paramus and Nilspar. She hid her tears against his chest.
"It's gonna be all right," Han murmured into her hair. "You should hear about some of the bad days I've had."
Leia laughed despite herself and hugged him fiercely.
"Let's go home."
"Can't think of one good reason not to."
Han bent to pluck his flight bag from the ground.
"Don't make too much of it, hon, but I kind of missed you."
23 hours out from Phonei, Plat Malar turned on the cockpit recorder of the TIE interceptor. His face was pale and slick with perspiration. He had fled Polnei
eluded the Avatha, and left Kornacht Cluster behind. But he could not escape the cold equations of time, energy, and distance. The ship's small oxygen reserve was gone. His rebreather could no longer cleanse the breaths he drew, and he suffered agonizing headaches. In 23 hours, not a single vessel of any size had been detected by the interceptor's targeting system. He knew he was going to die, and he was going to die alone. Rasping, he cleared his throat and began to speak.
My name is Platmalak. I was born in the city of Three North, on the planet Polnei. Yesterday, the 40th day of Moffat, warships attacked Polnei without any warning, without any cause. The combat recorders of my ship contain evidence of this attack, of the destruction of my home. They murdered my people, thousands and thousands and thousands. Please, help us. Please, if any are still alive, try to save them. Whoever sees this, you must find these monsters and punish them.
At last, Malar sagged back into his seat, exhausted by the effort of speaking. He was unconscious, barely clinging to life, when the crew of the 5th Fleet Prowler 5P8 stumbled on his hurtling ship. Leia peered through the transparasteel of the Fleet Infirmary's intensive care unit at the pale-faced young man who had just been transferred from a medical cocoon to the Bacta tank. A Fleet doctor and two MD-7 medical droids hovered over the biomonitors. Beside her stood Han and Admiral Akbar, who had awakened them on Han's first morning back home and insisted they accompany him. "Who is he?" Leia asked.
"He is Granon by stock, Polnei by allegiance," Akbar said. "His name is Platmalar. He's suffering from severe metabolic disruption due to breathing his own waste gases. He may not live. It appears he was trying to get a message out of Kornacht Cluster. Apparently the only way he could."
Leia's eyes flashed. "What message?"
"I will show you."
In the privacy of Admiral Akbar's offices at Fleet Headquarters, Han and Leia watched the holo recordings taken from Platmalar's TIE interceptor. When it was over, Leia pushed back from the table without a word, turning her back on Han and the Admiral. Hugging herself, she stood before the galactic holomap that covered nearly one wall. She was still staring into it with haunted eyes when she began to speak.
"Did you orchestrate all this to humiliate me, Akbar?"
"No, Leia,"
Akbar protested, surprised.
"I do not understand."
Han stood.
"That makes two of us. What are you talking about, Han? This doesn't have anything to do with you."
She whirled around to face them.
"Doesn't it? Look at him. He's just sitting there, waiting for me to draw the same conclusion he has. If you wanted to convince me to resign, Admiral, you couldn't have picked any better way."
Han looked to Akbar for help.
"I'm missing something here."
"Princess, you are wrong," said Akbar. "You could not be more wrong. You are the chief of state of the New Republic. We need your strength and dedication, more now than we did yesterday, to answer this challenge."
Akbar's praise left Leia untouched.
"Whose ships were those?"
"Platmalar got close enough to the first ship to interrogate it with his targeting system. It answered as the Imperial Star Destroyer Valorous. Valorous was one of the Black Sword ships."
"I know that. And if it was at Polnei, under Yvathan command, then you're looking at the biggest fool in the whole Republic. Isn't that why you brought me in here? Your subtle way of telling me I was wrong?"
Akbar shook his head.
"I thought that before you made your decision about giving up your work, you needed to know that there's still more for us to do. Whoever sent those ships to Polnei is the enemy of the peace you've tried so hard to build."
"Admiral Akbar's right,"
Han added. "All this other stuff, who burned the toast, who borrowed whose shirt, who left the light on, none of that matters. What matters is, what are we going to do now?"
"What can I do? Polnei wasn't a member of the New Republic. They weren't even applicants."
Han shook his head.
"You're talking about obligations. I'm talking about the right thing to do."
I'm sorry about Polnay, I truly am. But it's too late to help them. Besides, if I were to send forces anywhere near Kurnacht, I wouldn't have to resign. The Senate would hang me first and impeach me later. As soon as the door closed behind her, Han shot Akbar a quizzical look.
I have just one question. Who was that person? And what have you done with Leia?
I will tell you what I can, said Akbar. But I am afraid some of the answers will have to come from her.
A stranger was sitting cross-legged in the street outside the family entrance when Leia arrived home in a borrowed fleet skimmer. He was dressed in a long saffron robe that spilled out around him in a circle. She recognized neither his profile nor his species, but after she had disembarked and sent the speeder heading back, curiosity got the better of her. She walked out to the fence and called to him.
You! Who are you?
Jobath, Counselor of the Fear, of Galantos.
His face brightened.
But I know you. You are Princess Leia, the warrior queen, who rallied the oppressed to rise up against the Emperor. You saved my people from slavery. It is an honor to meet you.
What are you doing out there?
I am waiting for you. Your metal servant said that you were not receiving visitors, but my need is urgent. Princess, I've come about what's happening in the multitude.
The multitude? What's that?
The great multitude of the Circle of the Heavens. There is another name, an ugly name.
Are you talking about Kurnacht?
Yes, Kurnacht.
Jobath clasped the fence with long-fingered hands.
I've come to ask the protection of the New Republic and the great Princess Leia for my planet and my people. I beseech you to accept a petition for membership and fortify us against these murderers.
Leia started to back away. I'll consider your petition. Go to the diplomatic hostel. I'll send word to you there. Within an hour of Jobath's arrival at the diplomatic hostel, three other worlds with legations quartered there submitted emergency petitions for membership. All three, along with the Fia, received only silence in reply. Coruscant Global News Grid reported the rumor that Princess Leia had already resigned as president. Admiral Akbar. The man in the doorway wore casual civilian clothing, but he had the posture of a soldier in uniform.
Mr. Trayson, come in.
I'm not here to visit. Can you get me in to see Leia?
I'm afraid I cannot, said Akbar.
I have to talk to her.
Blinking slowly, Akbar sat back in his chair.
Do you know her husband?
Not professionally, but his loyalty to her is well known.
Akbar nodded thoughtfully.
He was here with me for 3 hours today. He was the one who ordered the prowlers to Kurnacht, not General Abbott.
Interesting.
There is more. He brought the Fifth Fleet back, as she ordered, but only as far as the outer marshalling point, and he kept it at combat readiness with full crews aboard. He understands the stakes. He may be more sympathetic than you expect, but I cannot promise that she will even listen to him.
Thank you, Admiral. If you'll excuse me.
Akbar held up a hand to detain him.
Admiral!
Yes?
I was wondering, could the Viceroy have done this to Leia? We know so little about the Yavetha. Is it possible that something happened in that room? That he has done something to her mind?
No. No, I can tell you that nothing happened in that room.
The answer did not seem to please Akbar. The sounds of splashing and childish laughter covered the crunch of footsteps on the walk, but Leia, with her wariness magnified by feelings of isolation, was aware of Admiral Drayson's approach before he had even emerged from the trees. Jaina quickly sensed her mother's dark mood.
Mommy, who's that? Do you want me to make him go away?
No. No, Leia said with a quick smile and tousled her daughter's wet hair. Jason, Jaina, Take Anakin inside. Drayson stopped a polite distance away, hands laced together behind his back.
Princess?
You know, if security is supposed to keep unwanted people out, the security around the presidential residence leaves a great deal to be desired.
Your husband admitted me, Princess Leia.
Did he? Well, my husband leaves a bit to be desired himself lately. What do you want?
5 minutes.
Drayson brought his right hand forward and showed her the data card he had cradled in his palm.
I think this will be useful to you in regard to the decision you are facing.
The data card contained a brief recording, time-stamped less than 2 hours earlier. It showed a pair of Yvathan thrust ships unloading on a hilly, brush-covered plateau. The kind and volume of material being unloaded and the shape and size of the clearing being made for it dictated one conclusion. It was the first phase of a colonization landing. Where is this?
The astrographic office knows it as Dornick 319. It's part of a system inside the Cornut Cluster. The Kubas, who lived there till yesterday, called it Morning's Bell.
What happened yesterday?
The same thing that happened to Polnei. It doesn't stop there. The evidence I've seen suggests that every non-Yevathan settlement in Kurnacht received the same sort of treatment.
What evidence? Where did you get this recording?
I'd rather you not ask me that, Princess.
Leia stared at him. Who are you, really?
I do what I do under the authority of an executive order issued by Mon Mothma. You'll find it in your personal library files as D9020616.
Mon Mothma? She never said a word about this.
She found the machinery of the New Republic inadequate when it came to certain aspects of statecraft. I tried to address those shortcomings.
After he left, Leia watched the recording a second time and then a third. Then she dug her comlink out of the drawer and selected a familiar channel. Han, you can stop hiding from me now. Please, come talk to me.
Murderous,
Han muttered as he watched the recording from Dornick 319. He shook his head disbelievingly.
I've been around long enough to see some cold moves, Pold. But killing a family one day and moving into their house the next is right up there with anything our old buddy Palpatine ever thought up.
Leia propped her chin on folded hands. I'm afraid it makes perfect sense. So much of what he said sounds different to me now, almost as though he'd lied to me with the truth. What we want more than anything is to be left alone. I remember that clearly from the first time we met. He mentioned how strange it was to see so many different species here. He told me the Yvatha didn't need our protection.
No, said Han. It was the Kubas who needed protection.
He as much as told me that, too. He said it was his mission to protect his people. And he did. He kept them inside that ship, safely away from us. He controlled his own exposure to us, as though he were afraid of contamination. All I can do now is make sure Nil Spar stays on his side of the moat. Protect the settlements that haven't been torched. She looked up at Han. I'm going to have to send the Fifth Fleet back to Farlax.
I thought that might happen. I left the fleet at readiness high. No shore leaves, no major maintenance. They should be able to sail on a half hour's notice.
She touched his hand. I'm sorry, I know you don't want this.
Hold on just a moment.
Han pulled back from her.
I'm not going anywhere.
I can't change commanders on them again. Not twice in a week. Not under these circumstances. You've been out there with them for 2 months now. That gives some continuity, at least.
Right idea, wrong man. If it were me, the first thing I'd do is hand the Fifth back to General Abbott.
How can I do that? He was disloyal to me.
Was he? He disobeyed an order you never should have given. And if that's your reason, you're going to have to disqualify me, too. That prowler that picked up Platmalar. What do you think it was doing out there?
She realized she had never asked herself that question. I assumed it was Admiral Drayson's handiwork.
Well, you weren't paying close enough attention. That's a Fifth Fleet prowler.
I sent it there.
You? Leia's eyes flashed anger. I don't understand. Is it because I'm a woman? Is that why everyone seems to treat my orders like suggestions?
Oh, geez, no, Leia. I keep telling you, the uniform doesn't fit me very well. I'm just as bad at following orders from men, you know that. Look, I was there, you weren't. I did it on a hunch.
But how can I ask General Abbott to come back? I humiliated him in front of his crew, his command.
If you think what you did changed how they felt about him, you've forgotten the rules of the game. What you did changed how they felt about you. Give them back their commander. You might even win back a couple of points.
Though he could have had one of the suites held for senior officers and guests if he had wanted it, General Abbott was billeted in a double in one of the enlisted dormitories. And though he had more than enough right to have it closed, the door to his room was standing open, respecting a tradition that redrew the boundaries of privacy from the first day of training. Abbott himself was on the floor, going through a strenuous series of body lifts without so much as a grunt. General? Leia said. May I come in?
The Dornian officer came to his feet smoothly and saluted smartly.
Princess, I am surprised to see you.
Leia pulled a straight-backed chair out from under the desk and sat down. General, a little while ago I decided that the hardest thing for me to do right now would be to stay where I am. And so that is what I'm going to do. And it's going to be hard enough that I need your help.
The loyalty of small men can be bought cheaply, because greed has no pride.
Within minutes of General Etan Abbott's return to the Fifth Fleet, the Armada jumped into hyperspace, heading for Farlax and Kornak Cluster. Within minutes of that event, Elizabeth Urn, Extraordinary Council of the Paquaporin, had reported it to Viceroy Neil Spahr by hyperspace comms.
Ben Kilnam, Admiral Akbar, Admiral Drayson, Leia, and Han were painstakingly crafting an announcement about the Yavathan massacres and a strategy to follow its release in the morning. They had just broken a deadlock over how to handle Platmalar's involvement. Leia was determined not to exploit him and carried the argument. When all four data pads on the table began to chirp warning signals, Leia silenced her alarm.
Channel One? Did any of you...
No, said Akbar.
Absolutely not, said Ben Kilnam.
Then who? Asked Drayson.
I got a bad feeling about this, Han said darkly.
The hollow monitor on the end wall came on by itself for a Channel One dispatch. It showed an image of Nil Spahr, who soon began to speak.
Citizens of the New Republic, I beg your indulgence for this intrusion, and I apologize for the unhappy news I must bring you. I am the Viceroy of the Duskan League, a free federation of Yavatha worlds in what you call the Kornak Cluster. I have come to you to tell you of events far from your home worlds, and to warn you of a danger very close at hand. 2 days ago, the forces of the Yavathan Protectorate successfully thwarted a deadly plot against our people and our way of life. The plot involved inhabitants of 3 planets.
3? Said Ben Kilnam. They can't count or tell the truth.
Located near the boundaries of our territory, these outsiders, whom we had generously allowed to settle on Yavathan soil, betrayed our trust and hospitality. All were discovered to be secretly assisting our enemies to prepare for an invasion. We acted swiftly and forcefully in our defense. All those responsible have been executed for their crimes.
Great stars, said Akbar. He's claiming credit for the massacres.
But you, the homeworld, remain in danger. Because the plot against us was hatched on Coruscant by a new generation of warlords,
I accuse President Princess Leia Organa Solo of high crimes against her office and against my people. If you do not renounce her, and you will not restrain her, then be prepared for war.
We hope you've enjoyed this production of Before the Storm by Michael P. Cuby McDowell. It was read by Anthony Heald. This program was produced by David Rapkin and directed by Lars Howell. Abridgment by Trevi Johnson. Before the Storm is a production of Lucasfilm Limited, copyright 1996, all rights reserved. The book, Star Wars, Before the Storm, Book 1 of the Black Fleet Crisis, is available wherever Bantam books are sold.